Calling of the Environment and Natural Resources Conference Committee to order. Today is May 4th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll. Adam.
Second here. Chair Hansen is present. Representative Wasilewicz.
Present.
Representative Morrison is just coming in right now. Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Fisher present. Representative Heinzelman.
Heinzelman present.
Senator Ingebretson.
Ingebretson present.
Senator Rood.
Present.
Senator Tomasoni. Senator Westrum. Senator Eichhorn. We'll go back here. Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Senator Tomasoni. Senator Westrum. And it looks like Senator Eichhorn is just also coming in here. And that will conclude the roll.
So Senator Eichhorn is present?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am. Just got logged on.
A quorum is present. Members, I just a little bit of a roadmap today. We have a number of agencies here for testimony, and I would encourage members to ask questions about the budget and other items. I am going to have to leave at about 10 o'clock to go into another conference committee for about 15 minutes. So Vice Chair Wasilewicz will take the gavel at that moment. So we will start, and we're going to start with the smaller agencies first. First up, we have Mark Murphy with the Minnesota Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ingebretson.
If I could, please, Mr. Chair, there's some handouts I think you may have gotten, or did you get handouts from the departments? I think our members got those, but I'm assuming they sent them to you as well. So.
Yep, I think they're all. Mr. Strohmeyer, are those posted?
Yep, they're all posted, and I sent a corrected version of the MPCA letter this morning, and it's posted now as well.
So for Minnesotans watching at home, you can log on. Are they on both committees, or where are they posted, Mr. Strohmeyer?
They are posted on both committees' sites for the meeting notices.
Okay. Senator Ingebretson, any other questions?
I just wanted to make note of that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Murphy, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name and who you're with and provide some testimony. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. My name is Mark Murphy. I'm the Executive Director of the Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa, and I will try to keep my remarks brief since I have been with your committee once before. The Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa is an independent nonprofit. We're proud to serve and work to improve access to outdoors, outdoor recreation, provide habitat restoration on public lands, and to protect water quality. Our mission is to engage youth and young adults in meaningful service, leadership development, and environmental stewardship. I'm aware that many of the members of the committee are familiar with the Corps. We have been around a long time and previously worked inside the Minnesota DNR, but today as an independent nonprofit, we're proud to serve many agencies, of which DNR is our largest partner. Over the last 2 year biennium, we provided about 60,000 acres in restoration and improvements. We provided about 3,500 miles of trail maintenance. That's water, ways, and trails. We planted about 117,000 trees, and our members, which were about 714 young people, provided about 600,000 hours in service. About 70% of our work is in habitat, natural resource management, and work on trails and waterways. About 20% of our time is spent on training and workforce development and education for the people that we do serve. Our budget, a couple of years ago, last biennium, it might have been around $10 million, but over the last few years, it has operated around $8.5 million. We had much fewer expenses, we did have fewer expenses last year due to pausing our youth programming during the pandemic. But we did still maintain our adult group program in a very substantial way. We are here because we have been getting appropriations from the state of Minnesota from the general fund for our general operations, and also for natural resources dedicated funds. We've been getting the same amount for about 12 years running. We appreciate that. We're very thankful. It is an important part of our pie of the resources that we do receive. We do receive other resources through legacy amendment funds and other sources indirectly from the agencies that we work with. Our priorities in the coming year are really to continue to be resilient in the face of the pandemic. We're still operating with our COVID protocols. We're bringing on people, and we have a full crew. We're anticipating about 370 core members this year right now. That's youth and young adults. Our focus over the next few years is to continue to improve our recruitment so we can maximize our ability to serve our partners. Our focus is really needs to be on bringing and increasing equitable access to our programs. There are many new communities in Minnesota that want to experience the outdoors and want to have the opportunity to learn natural resource management skills and potential for careers in those fields and that sector. We do see a great need with the increasing demand on the parks and green spaces in general. There is increasing demand from our partners, so we need to make sure that we're increasing our ability to bring our crews to serve those partners, whether it's DNR or MPCA or a local city or county agency. And lastly, we need to make new partners. So we're reaching out to try to create new partnerships so that perhaps we can create new kinds of opportunities for different underrepresented people that have not been parts of our crews before. Again, I really thank you for the opportunity to be here. We appreciate the support from the state of Minnesota, and I am happy to take any questions.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Minister Chair. I don't know if you wanted to wait for questions or.
I'd like to take them while we're with each member if you have questions for Mr. Murphy,
yep.
Now would be the time.
So, okay.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Murphy, thank you for the work you do at the Conservation Corps. It's a tremendous, tremendous job, tremendous opportunity for young folks. Can you tell me, and I'm sorry if I missed this, can you tell me the range last year, maybe as an example, how far did you range in the state of Minnesota geographically, and what kind of jobs they were, just real quickly?
In terms
Mr.
of-
Mr. Murphy.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We covered the number, I think we covered all but two legislative districts. Yeah, completed service in 132 of 134 legislative districts in the two-year biennium. Again, I don't have the information in front of me to break down the two different years because we collect the data over the 2 years. In terms of the range of jobs that we do, I described them in there, but we do everything from off-road vehicle trail maintenance to parks and trails maintenance to invasive species removal to clean about 8 to 10 different rivers where we clean the blockage and the logs and the kinds of stuff that are in the waterways so that canoeists and kayakers and people using those trails can get on the riverways. We do tree plantings all over the state. We do general shoreline maintenance and cleanup. We work in legislative districts connected to projects that the DNR bring to us with our partners in each of the DNR regions. We also work with park districts in many of the different cities, both outstate, Duluth, Rochester, as well as the Twin Cities, the broader metro. That gives you a flavor. We work in state parks, certainly. We every year, as you know, we have a presence in St. Croix Park with our Summer Youth Corps program. We didn't have that last year because the park was closed to us from housing and camping standpoint, but we were still in those parks doing trail maintenance on a in and out basis.
Sure.
Does that help?
Mayor Ingebrigtsen.
Real quickly, it's either yes or no, and I don't know this. Do you work in collaboration with the Sentence to Serve people at all on all corporate projects? Okay, thanks. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Murphy, for your presentation and for the really important work. It's so crucial that we train in risk management, and you know, as we look at the way young people have responded to COVID and families, getting outside and engaging with nature is absolutely critical to, boy, the future of managing our state, facing climate change, all those issues. So you just do such important work. My question is a quick one. Just what are the, you mentioned that you do get legacy amendment dollars, and I'm just wondering what the appropriation was last year and this year, if you know off the top of your head.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, through the Legacy Amendment Funds, actually, we don't get them directly. The DNR gets a designation to spend, and I think this year, and previously, it had been $1 million. This year, that's been cut to $850,000. The Board of Soil and Water also gets $500,000 designated to work with us in terms of specific projects to their needs, and that, again, is the amount that's in the current bill.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Any other, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Murphy, for your presentation today. I appreciate hearing more about your agency or about the Conservation Corps. One of the questions I have is in the demographics of the, particularly the young people who are doing the work out there, what percentage are of the, you know, out of the total numbers, how many are the youth, where are they from, what are the demographics? And then after that is, if the LCCMR bill was not approved, how does that impact your employing of these folks in the coming biennium?
Thank you.
Mr. Murphy.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Exact demographics, I have to get you because I don't have them here in front of me. I can tell you generally. The young people we work with, that is the 60 to 18-year-olds, our youth, who are mostly from the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. And there are statewide youth that come to our Summer Youth Corps program. They are more diverse. We have a greater diversity among them, and I can't give you those numbers offhand, and I'm happy to send you the demographics. Our AmeriCorps volunteers who spend, rather than the youth who spend just parts of the day of a week for the spring semester or the fall semester, or they come to our Summer Youth Corps, that's the young opportunity youth, you might call them. The young adults who are coming through the AmeriCorps program tend to be less diverse, not by choosing, because they tend to be college student age that are taking a gap year off. And so there are definite barriers to attract a more diverse participant base to those. It is an area we've worked on for quite a while. We certainly, in the issue of equity and inclusion, are focusing more about that. We've had initiatives to work with tribal communities, and we are talking to partners in the metro area about how we could create some programming that gives people that live in the city the opportunity to get to the outdoors and work in these areas. But again, there's big barriers to bring the young adults into the program because of just economic barriers, housing, transportation, the fact that we only pay a stipend of about $1,400, limits some people's ability to be able to take that kind of time off. To your other question, I forget what your other question was now.
LCCMR.
LCCMR, yeah. Okay, I'll take these one at a time. We do get funding. This general appropriations goes to, I'll give you the high level. So about 10% of our funding, $8 million a year, about 10% of our funding is really dependent on this appropriations that we get from you. About 15% of our funding comes from the AmeriCorps program that is essentially the seed funding we get to bring on all these AmeriCorps workers, and then we match that funding by going out and building partnerships with state agencies. So about 70% of our work is fee-for-service. That fee-for-service comes from sources like LCCMR, who funding agencies that hire us to do that work. It also comes from, like I said, city, other agencies, park agencies. So the LCCMR funding would be a major dent depending on which agencies it's hitting in terms of their reduction in their ability to contract with us to do service.
Then, Mr. Murphy, we're going to have to get moving here, but I have two quick questions.
Yep.
So overall, if we move past June 30th and you don't get your budget, that'll have an impact if you're this base funding is about 8 to 10%. There's quite a bit of news on the federal government looking at reconstituting a modern day version of the CCC because we are, I think there are about 20 states that have some type of version. Any news on that? If that would require state matching, if there's a federal program starting up again, or would they provide federal dollars into existing state programs?
Yeah, not news on matching. We actually had our national agency person here last week talking to our board about this. It's still very much in the making. We are asking, there are three or four bills. They all have different versions of a civilian climate corps or enhanced funding for AmeriCorps programming. It's either going to go through the agencies, federal agencies funding, and they will look to agencies like us. We're asking at a national level if they consider our agencies first, but it's still very much a moving process. There is talk that some of that funding is going to go to states, and then states will have to figure out their own programming, but it's still very much a moving target.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. We'll move on to Metropolitan Council.
Thank you.
Lisa Barajas. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had to get myself unmuted and video up here. My name is Lisa Barajas. I am the Community Development Director at the Metropolitan Council, and I'm really pleased to be here today on behalf of the 10 regional parks implementing agencies with whom we coordinate to plan and deliver the regional parks and trail system in the Twin Cities metro area. I'm going to keep my remarks really brief because I've had an opportunity to be in front of most of you already, but I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity operations and maintenance funding that is included in these bills. As many of you know, our parks and trails are already very well loved in the metro area. And during this last year with COVID, we've seen such an increase in demand to be in the outdoors recreating and exercising or just getting some fresh air, as has already been discussed. This, of course, puts a lot of stress on our system. And with COVID protocols, our costs have gone up. So we truly appreciate the inclusion of this funding this year. I'm happy to take any other questions you might have.
Members, any questions? Ms. Barajas, what if you don't get your funding on July 1st? What happens?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the operations and maintenance funding is really important to our work. That being said, a good portion of the regional parks and trails operations and maintenance costs are already covered by our implementing agencies. This just helps us go that extra mile to do even more and keep the system up and running. So we could manage for some time, but certainly this would put a dent in the overall budgets for each of our implementing agencies that would be hard to recover from.
Members, any other questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Allison Rempel Brown, Science Museum of Minnesota. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I, as we all have had to get off of mute, and I'm happy to be here with you. So good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Allison Rempel Brown, and I have the honor to serve as President and CEO of the Science Museum of Minnesota. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. I'm joined by John Severson. He's our Director of Government Relations. I'm here today to speak in support of several provisions in the Omnibus Bill, all of which play a unique and important role in the museum's long-term recovery and ability to deliver essential programming and scientific research to our great state and the citizens within the state. The first of these is the museum's general appropriation, which annually provides $1,079,000 and is vital for general operating support for the institution. These funds support across our organization, ensure a clean, safe, and secure experience for hundreds of thousands of visitors. We are welcoming back to the museum over the coming biennium. And I also speak in support of the House's $1,939,000 appropriation, which will provide crucial one-time funding to stabilize the museum's financial position and begin the planning process to bring back staff as visitor confidence and operational capacity continues to increase over the coming years. And the last is the scientists at our St. Croix Watershed Research Station have two recommended projects in the fiscal year 20 Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. These projects provide timely insights into the source of the blue-green algae blooms in Minnesota's pristine lakes and the emergence of the invasive rock spot in the North Shore rivers. The time is really to understand and act on these issues now while we have time to identify solutions, and I urge your support for these projects and thank you. As we testified in both bodies this session, the financial impact of COVID-19 pandemic was really significant for the Science Museum of Minnesota. Despite these challenges, the museum stayed focused on serving the state in many powerful ways. We pivoted to deliver digital learning programs and experiences for parents and teachers and students throughout Minnesota. And the museum started in March of 2020 with 499 employees. That was 499 employees. We're now down over 50% to about 250 employees due to the pandemic. And even after other significant expense reductions in other areas, we project an operating loss of at least $15 million over the two-year period starting last March and continuing through March 2022 due to the pandemic's direct and indirect impact. And the museum continues to advocate at the city, county, state, and federal levels to make decision makers aware of the financial challenges we face, along with other major cultural institutions in our region. The Science Museum did receive a PPP loan of $4.5 million through the CARES Act and subsequently received a $2 million PPP2 loan through the Consolidated Appropriations Act. And we're awaiting decision on our forgiveness of our request for PPP1, which was submitted just last April, last month, and PPP2 forgiveness will be submitted in fall of 2021. We have also seen a net benefit from the employee retention tax credit, having received $700,000 in credits as of the end of Q1. We're grateful for the PPP loans and additional relief we've received. There are still significant challenges ahead, and we know that moving forward. The shuttered venues provision of Consolidated Appropriations Act included museums. The museum, Science Museum, though, did not meet the necessary budget requirements, and we were ineligible to access a significant source of funding for cultural organizations. And we are now closely monitoring the American Rescue Plan and its provisions for supporting American students with summer, out-of-school time, and enrichment programs. These are skills and programs where we excel. We are in the initial stages of reaching out to school and district administrators to see where we can partner to be part of the statewide solution. What we do know is that no single source of relief will make our organization whole. And we also see the passage of this significant legislation would be a significant step forward in righting our financial ship. Our financial reserves are limited and significantly depleted as we weather the closures throughout most of this past year. And the museum is now using reserves earmarked not just for short-term emergencies, such as a pandemic, but also reserves set aside for investing in its future. And with a greatly reduced staff, we navigated our way through this crisis using balanced mix of reserves, prior state funding, PPP loans, and worked really, really hard to retain and attract philanthropic support from corporate, foundation, and private donors. And we understand the importance of diversified revenue and building equity within our statewide community. We also know that the state of Minnesota is a major stakeholder in the current and future success of our organization. And as a leader in inspiring our future workforce, as a repository of Minnesota history, and as a place we simply enjoy going with family and friends. And with that, I ask for your support of the provisions that I just went through as a vital cash flow to the museum to power our research and allow us to relaunch both in-person and digital science programming for all Minnesotans. I'd like to end with a quote from a recent visitor comment. She wrote, "I felt a little guilty enjoying myself when there's so much pain in my community. So seeing the race exhibit was a major relief. My child, 3 years old, was able to appreciate some of what we were seeing, but mostly it was fun, energizing place for us to enjoy one another's company in new ways we cannot replicate at home or on our own. I am so grateful to have a place to celebrate science and show my children how science applies to so many different earthly situations. I know I could come back over and over again and continue to see new things. I look forward to seeing my children absorb more as their awareness grows with age." So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And at this time, we'll gladly stand for questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you so much, Ms. Brown, for that great presentation and for the work you do. I know the Science Museum has had an outsized role in my children's growth and development over the years, and it's just a gem of our state. I appreciate the creativity that sounds like the museum has exhibited in trying to find funding sources and, you know, looking outside of obviously state, considering philanthropic and corporate giving as well. I'm just wondering, can you kind of be straight with us and tell us what the implications for the museum would be if you didn't get state funding this year?
Brown.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, we will have to continue with a reduction in the work that we do, particularly around our science and in our education areas. The museum is open at a reduced capacity, and we are hoping that we can continue to expand the museum side. But the areas where we will, and be very honest about this, the areas where we have to continue our reduced programs will be around science and education. And those are the areas that we know we need to expand. We will continue with our digital work in those areas, but this funding will really help us grow our science and education work and with a focus on centered on equity.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
Ms. Brown, earlier in the session, you know, we had testimony from you about numbers, and I think since that time you were able to access some additional PPP loans, but the number that sticks in my mind was $3.9 million for an insurance claim that was denied. If you could maybe elaborate on that, on lost revenue shortfall, and then overall I thought we had a number of $15 million
as well. So maybe just showing the debt and then any communication with the executive branch on federal dollars, additional federal dollars that may be discretionary.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and committee members. And also John Severson can chime in with some additional information. So the $3.9 million was the a claim that we made with our insurance company for having to be closed last year during the pandemic. And they denied the claim, not saying, and I can't remember all the final details on it. And John, I don't know if you remember them, Barry Gisser, who was our CFO, testified and has the details on why they denied the claim. With that, John, do you have the details in your head?
Mr. Severson, if you have the details.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Yes, it was a business interruption claim.
If you could just state your name and who you're with for the record.
John Severson with the Science Museum of Minnesota. Thank you. It was a business interruption claim. There were, as you stated, $3.978 million. It was the determination of the insurance company that the pandemic was not the direct result of that. It did not qualify, and I believe that was the case for many such claims that were made.
And then, Chair, and thank you, Chair and committee members. And your question about the $15 million is that we estimated this time that we will have a $15 million operating loss over the two-year period. We estimate that we will have an impact of reduced revenues from the pandemic from starting with March when we closed last year, March 2020, and we'll have reduced revenues through March 2022. People are starting to come back to the museum, but we right now are reduced capacity limits, and people still are not comfortable coming back fully to the museum, and then there are other impacts as well to the museum from the pandemic. And so those result in an operating loss as well that we need to cover through our reserves and other sources.
And then just on the layoffs, those are permanent layoffs. If you could, or those, could you give those numbers again of just pre-pandemic and current payroll?
Before the pandemic, so this be early March, before we had to close, we closed in mid-March. Our payroll was 499 employees, and we're now just under 250 employees. And those are permanent layoffs, although we hope that we can bring some of those employees back as we are able to expand some of our programs in science and particularly in education. And that's what some of this funding would help us if we try to grow back some of these areas that we've had to put on pause during this period.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Rappel Brown, for the always good testimony. I think you're very, very clear in what goes on there, and we all know that this is a jewel in Minnesota, and I go back a little ways where we'd actually did some funding to repair the back problem. It seems like just a couple of years ago, but I'm sure it's even more than that. We did a bonding situation where the I believe it was the drainage, and we had to jack up the corner and fix it. And it was agreed upon at that time by all members. I think this was way too good a building to let go, and all the good work that goes on there and the kids. And you're so right. You're so right. We have kids are been basically detained an awful lot from coming out and enjoying these things, and I'm sure your agency is looking forward to it. You may know that I come up with a tough target this year, and we've been working with it, but we also didn't reduce your budget. So I hope that the in the days ahead we can come together and make this happen. At least that's my hope. But it's going to take some consideration by not only the our committee but also the administration before we move forward. So, but thank you so much for the work you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. We are looking forward to be able to do more work, help where we can with these children, and also I want to say their parents. This has been a really challenging year for children and parents alike. And parents have been on double duty at home with their kids and doing their, of course, they love their children. They want them to do well. And children, you know, are social. They want to be with their friends. They don't understand why they have to be at home. And we want to be part of that solution and partnering with others. And then back to the building. Yes, thank you also for the support and the bonding that helped us repair the building. We finished that project on time and on budget, and the building is safe and secure. And we are excited to welcome people back into the building. We'll be so excited to be able to welcome school groups back into the building. We can't do that just yet, but we are building plans for that as well, and to do that safely.
Ms. Brown, do you have any indication of federal discretionary dollars or I'm not talking about the PPP, I'm talking about money that's come to the state?
We do not, but we are monitoring that and working with that and making certain we have a good eye on where we can work with other agencies and where those funds are that would be appropriate for us, really around science and education and centered on equity. So we are keeping an eye on that and working closely, and also working closely with the museum agencies, so the American Alliance of Museum and the Association of Science and Technology Centers.
And Ms. Brown, if we do not have a budget on July 1st, as you're coming out of COVID here, what does that mean if we're in government shutdown with no budget?
We will have to. We do our cash flow projections weekly, and cash flow is for everybody is a topic that is top of mind. So we will have to monitor our cash flows. And we are actually looking at talking with our banks to make certain that we can keep our cash flows balanced and in order. And this will just be another thing that we have to add into that conversation because, you know, who knew as a leader that would be something we talk about at each of our weekly meetings. This will be another wrinkle into that discussion.
Members, any other questions? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Brown, for your presentation today. I understand being in a nonprofit, how tight cash flow has gotten during this time. I take it you folks have a line of credit. How far into your line of credit are you folks currently, and how much space do you have going into the future? And that's when I hear cash flow, that kind of sends up, that sounds like things are getting really tight when you're looking at it on a weekly basis.
Ms. Brown.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't have the exact answer to that question. We don't have Barry on the call, or Barry Gisser, our chief financial officer, who would have the answer, but we can get that for you. We are in negotiations with our current bank about our letter of credit, our line of credit, excuse me. And so I just don't have the answer right on top of with me right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Brown. Next up, Katie Pratt with the Environmental Quality Board.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Katie Pratt. I'm the Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the board. I'm really pleased to be here. And I want to discuss first budget as it relates to EQB and then touch on two policy provisions. And my comments today are also outlined in a letter, which you all should have. So first, with EQB's budget, we want to signal our support for the House version of the budget, and also just highlight the impact that a budget reduction would have for EQB. EQB plays a unique role in addressing cross-jurisdictional environment and natural resource issues. We have 9 state agency leaders who sit on our board and 8 members of the public, 1 from each congressional district. Every dollar invested in EQB is multiplied. We lead collaborative interagency projects that leverage time and experience from our member agencies and help our state move faster on environment and natural resource outcomes. Our work is in high demand. We continually hear from members of the public across the state that they want more opportunities, not less, to engage with the board and advance collaborative problem solving. Our budget is already lean, and reductions would mean that Minnesotans would have less access to board activities on the issues they care about. We would be forced to cut one staff position if our budget is reduced by the amount in the Senate version, and that's about 10% of our staff capacity for context. And that would mean we would scale back our work plan for the next biennium. Second, I want to touch on a couple of policy provisions here. First, EQB supports the deadline extension in the 404 for the 404 assumption study that is included in the Senate version of Article 2. So EQB has entered into an agreement with Bowser to implement this project, and we're working closely with them. COVID-19 created challenges in coordinating with federal agencies, and we really appreciate the extra time to develop the final study and have a thoroughly researched project there. And then second policy provision is in Article 2, the Senate-only Section 128. This contains a provision changing the environmental review citizen petition process. It requires that signatories reside or own property in the county of a proposed project or in an adjoining county, rather than residing anywhere in the state as is currently allowed. EQB opposes this change. A couple of reasons. First, we completed a preliminary analysis of citizen petition addresses and found that the majority fall within the county or the adjacent county of the proposed project. Therefore, we feel this change is not needed. Second, we recognize that Minnesotans might have cultural or recreational ties to a project location, but may not reside or own property in that area. Not all Minnesotans can afford to own property in the places that matter to them, and this should not prevent them from requesting environmental review if they are concerned about environmental impacts to those places. And then finally, air and water don't respect county boundaries. Projects could have the potential for significant environmental impacts beyond county boundaries. And those are my comments this morning. I thank you very much for your time, and I will stand by for questions.
Representative Fisher. Representative Fisher.
Thank you. I thought I'd unmuted. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Pratt, for your presentation. One of the things I heard you mention in your presentation is you were mentioning about scaling back plans going forward. What does that mean when you say you're scaling back plans? What is the impact of that?
Ms. Pratt.
Yes, thank you for that question. The impacts are primarily in three areas. One is engagement. We hear from the public across all our different project areas, and EQB touches on everything from water to pollinators. We take on a lot of different issue areas, and we hear from the public that they want to engage on these issues. They want to have their voices heard. They want to have meetings. They want to talk about these things. They want to have contacts to the board. And our ability, this takes staff time. So that's one area where we would see us having to scale back our plans. Another area is in the environmental review program. We see a continual need for more guidance and support for folks doing environmental review, updating materials, updating guidance. And that, again, is something that's labor intensive, and we have to scale back what we can take on for our next biennium, depending on our staff capacity. And then the third area I would highlight is our interagency work. You know, a number of issues come to EQB, and we find that there is a continual need to continue to convene agencies on it. Emerald Ash Borer is a good example. We produced a report in 2020 on Emerald Ash Borer, highlighting the issues and concerns and the need for policies and funding going forward on EAB. We produced that report, but the need to convene agencies and continue working on these issues, it goes on, right? We don't solve it just by putting out a report. And so we find that in a lot of our issue areas that there's a desire to have EQB continue to convene. And again, that takes staff time and energy and resources.
Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Pratt. I was interested when you say you were mentioning about the public input and public engagement. How's that been impacted by COVID? How has COVID impacted you from the not only the public engagement, but the funds that are needed for that kind of work going forward? You can explain a little bit on that. And then also, if you can explain if the dollars are not available that you need on July 1st, how does that impact public engagement on as to with everything that you're working on.
Ms. Pratt.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It has been an unusual year, and in 2020, we've had to move most of our engagement to digital and virtual formats. That's been a learning curve. There are some things we've learned that we'll actually keep with that. There are some advantages to doing virtual formats. But in general, we've had to really scale back. In 2020, it just wasn't possible to get out into communities and get out across the state as we typically would. We typically would hold gatherings, hold meetings, convenings in different places around the state, and we would like to do more of that. If our funding is scaled back come July 1, we'd have to really think about and what could we take on and what could we not, and scale back our plans for how much we could get out there. And in general, the virtual formats, they're less expensive in terms of time and resources, but there's limitations. We've heard too that the quality of dialogue, the quality of relationship building and human connections that are so important to solving these complex problems just isn't always there with those virtual formats. And so we really want to make sure that we can, when we're past this pandemic, get back out and connect with communities across Minnesota.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Pratt. I appreciate hearing that. So it sounds like, from what I'm understanding, is that the challenges of COVID and the availability to dollars is have an impact on being able to engage the public, making sure that we're getting the full input as these different projects come forward. And that is concerning about the impact of COVID and concerning about what might happen if dollars are not available as we need going forward. Because I feel that with the work that you do, public engagement is so key to be able to get that input from people from across our state on the issues facing us in the environment. So thank you for the work that you do.
Ms. Pratt, you mentioned EAB, and we have some significant funding for EAB. How would you describe the spread of EAB and the urgency, if there is one, for a response?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I can speak to what we hear from communities across the state. They really reached out to EQB. In fact, that is how we got involved in this issue to begin with. Issues come to EQB for various formats. EAB was not one that was legislatively directed or even kind of came from our board members, but it came from communities saying they just feel a real urgency. They don't know what to do. How are they going to address the dead wood that they have in their communities? We know that we are continuing to hear from them that they're looking to the state to take leadership and action. I can also speak to the fact that, climate change is significant. The amount of ash that we're going to lose across the state is significant when we think about climate change and the need to sequester carbon in our forests. So, we hear that it's high. Our interagency team continues to convene on it, and we're watching closely the legislative process and the discussions that this committee is having. And we look forward to working with you all on this issue going forward.
And Ms. Pratt, your agency also, does a pollinator report and grades the effort, and some of the conference report in front of us, there are significant cuts to pollinator projects in the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And I think the comment was made is we've just done enough on pollinators. We don't need to do any more. And so I'd like your impression on whether the crisis is solved.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Again, I will answer that by speaking to what we hear coming towards us from the public. And again, there is a great, great concern on behalf of the public and Minnesotans about pollinators and about the state of our pollinators. We know through our interagency collaborative process that there is a real deficit of research and science to help us make smart management decisions around pollinators and around land use. So we know there are needs there. We know there is continued education and outreach needs around pollinators. This is an issue that everybody's going to have to participate in if we want our thriving having healthy pollinator populations. So getting the word out there more to Minnesotans, that's a real need. And yeah, continued strategic thinking around, you know, what are the key policies, the key actions that the state needs. That takes time. That takes time and interagency collaboration and interjurisdictional collaboration to think about how we be most strategic. And so I do think there's continued needs in all of those areas.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Pratt, for the information. And with regards to the bees, you said there are concerns about the pollinators and not enough research. Is there a concern, or is there some kind of a dire emergency for this kind of research? Or I think you used the word, you're certainly concerned. We should all be certainly concerned, but is it to the point where without this funding, there's no return? Or dive into that a little further for me, would you please?
Ms. Pratt.
Yeah, thanks for that question. You know, when we're talking about pollinators, we're talking about complex ecosystems, and there's no easy, simple answer to whether tomorrow is the drop dead, you know, day that everything's gonna, you know, that our pollinator species are gonna be in dire danger, or whether it's 2 weeks from now. I think our interagency experts feel that this is not an issue we can kind of sit idle and just, you know, kind of watch and wait on. This is an issue that we need to be proactive on and continuing to get kind of two steps ahead of. So from our interagency experts, there is real urgency to continue making, you know, making a push on pollinators. They're very important to, you know, fundamental to so many of our ecosystems across the state.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Matt, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Next up, John Edmond, Explore Minnesota Tourism.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
We can, and welcome to the conference committee, Mr. Edmond, and congratulations on your retirement. Thank you for all your work for the people of Minnesota over the years.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. First of all, my name is John Edmond. I'm the director of Explore Minnesota, and thank you for those comments. It's truly been an honor to work on behalf of all of you and for the state of Minnesota for the past 22 years. I'll keep my comments, Mr. Chair and members, relatively brief. As you all know, tourism is a $16 billion industry in the state of Minnesota. And as a result of the pandemic, our industry experienced significant losses. We lost almost half of the sales of our industry in the last year, $8.2 billion, which affected businesses, hotels, resorts, retail shops in every single part of the state of Minnesota. That being said, as the vaccine becomes more available to consumers, consumer confidence starts to rise, we are optimistic about what the future is for travel and tourism. We're experiencing or seeing that people are going to still be traveling closer to home. They're not going to be venturing as far out. They're going to be looking for things in the outdoors, the natural resources, things that where they can social distance. Domestic travel, we feel, will first rise before business travel. Meetings, international, group will be slower. We also have a challenge with branding awareness for the state of Minnesota right now as a result of all of the civil unrest. But there, again, is some optimism for the future of travel and tourism in Minnesota. First of all, I want to comment just briefly on the budgets for Explore Minnesota as passed by the House and the Senate and the governor's proposal. The operating budget for our agency is relatively the same all across the board at about $14.3 million for each year of the next in the biennium upcoming. And that puts Explore Minnesota roughly in the middle of the pack when it comes to state tourism budgets. Now, just a couple of little differences that I've noted in the House and in the Senate bill. The House has money for $500,000 for an events grants program, as well as $250,000 for Grand Portage, whereas the Senate has $880,000 for a recovery grant program involving meetings, events, DMOs, et cetera. While we don't have a, first of all, we appreciate both the Senate and the House's efforts to provide grant funding for these areas in need for Minnesota tourism. Currently, we feel that the House bill is probably a little easier to administer because it's focused on events. Events are having to reinvent themselves. They've been incredibly decimated, and we've done an event grant program in the past. While the Senate version of the grants program is much appreciated, it's at a higher level of funding amount. It's rather broad in that it addresses meetings, conventions, events, as well as DMO funding. And to put this a little bit into perspective, this last year, we were able to repurpose some of our marketing dollars because we essentially were not able to get out there with consumer marketing messages. And we had two rounds of grants specifically just for DMOs, destination marketing organizations. And that totaled about over $2 million. And that was gobbled up really fast. So if we had $880,000 for DMOs, for events, for meetings, those dollars, frankly, would not go very far and be gobbled up extremely fast. So that's why I think the preference is just to have it a little bit more focused as the House bill is. But overall, I think I just want to conclude that I appreciate the support that I've received from all of you, from the bodies in the House and the Senate, for Explore Minnesota, for our funding. It'll greatly assist in our recovery, which we do feel is going to take a while. It's going to probably take over the next 2 years before we get back to where we were. But with these resources that you are making available to our agency, it will greatly assist our industry to getting back towards the recovery to the level that we should be. And so with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Members, any questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen, it sounded like a deal there. We could take the Senate amount and the House program and we're done. That'd be great.
Well, that's just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking kind of on those lines. However, you know, a little over $880,000 more than what the House has. And I guess directing that money, you know, I just wanted to make note of that because those are obviously real important to our members and bringing that forward. So I think there's a place we can, you know, we can certainly look at here in the coming days. I just hope we're able to do that, Rick. Thanks.
Mr. Edmund, I have a question about money. Unless, Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you have a follow-up question or about federal money in terms of is there, you know, when we have an existing program, when you have an existing program, is there some vehicle there for federal discretionary money to provide grants for events, or is that just not really a possibility?
If you're talking about the Federal Recovery Program dollars, Mr. Chair, yes, I think that is a possibility. I guess I wouldn't mind sharing with you that we have put in some requests for some additional grants for the industry as a part of those federal dollars, as well as more of extensive consumer recovery programs to help businesses throughout the state, some consumer marketing programs, the status of which I'm not sure. I think, as you probably know better than I, it's really a matter of determining the federal guidelines and how that all fits together at this point. But we did put that request through the Department of Economic Development into the governor's office. And so, like all of you, we'll wait and see.
I'm just thinking as an example, you know, we in South St. Paul, we have the World Championship Booyah Cook-Off in the fall, and that had to be canceled last year to great dismay of Booyah connoisseurs around the state, and trying to get that back and going and promoted, you know, if there were grants for that, it would seem like it would be a COVID-related recovery, you know, trying to promote and bring those events. And there's events like that all over the state, not the World Championship, but there are events like that. And I know Senator Ingebrigtsen would want to come and maybe be a judge for that. But those are the type of things, you know, Minnesotans enjoy their community events and they draw people. And it would seem that that might be something for federal money. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, thank you. That's quite interesting. Now that you open up that door, you know, we have huge lutefisk feeds out in my neck of the woods, and I don't know that they're involved with the Explore Minnesota tourism, but now you're going to have to explain to me what Huya event is. I don't know what that is.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, when you have stockyards, you have a lot of parts, and you have stew that can be made in a big tub. There was just Booyah at the Croatian Hall, I think, last week. There might be some Booyah, I think, at the Moose Club in Invergrove this weekend. So if you're around, let's connect. Maybe we can get the deal done there. And the rest of our conference committee is rolling their eyes right now. So I think, Mr. Edmund, thank you again for all of your work for the people of Minnesota over the last 22 years.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Frawley, Minnesota Zoo, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is John Frawley, Director of the Minnesota Zoo. With me today is Abigail Mosier and Missy Remick, or McGrath. The mission of the Minnesota Zoo is to connect people to animals and the natural world to save wildlife. And so today I'll give you a quick overview of where we stand so far in the pandemic. As you all know, the Minnesota Zoo is a state agency where one third of our funding comes from the state and two thirds of our funding is earned revenue, where we roll up our sleeves and we have a strong business plan to run our organization. Obviously, that business plan flipped upside down March 13th when we had to close the zoo, and that two-thirds of our revenue was shut off. When that happened, the years before that, the zoo was in a very strong financial position. We had some of our best years in the last two, 3 years before the pandemic shut us down, but when it did hit, of course, we at the zoo had to freeze all of our expenditures. We canceled all of our major projects and contracts. And unfortunately, we had to move into a financial model that required us to do a major reduction in staff and layoffs of Minnesota Zoo and state employees, which included about 33% of our workforce, which had been cut back and has remained for the most part cut back through the entire pandemic, which has put the zoo probably in the toughest position it's ever been in its 42 years. But we were able to get to this point. I will say on behalf of the staff, the zoo did step up with that limited resources through the pandemic, offered, you know, free camps and free curriculums statewide to serve, you know, those parents and kids and teachers that were trying to do things from home. We did offer a couple of creative opportunities with a drive-through zoo and a nature illuminated, you know, safe car-driven events that people could do during the pandemic. So continue to serve the state. But at this point, we are starting to increase our capacity a little bit. Over the winter, we were restricted to only on 250 people indoors, which is a very small capacity for the zoo, but that's now starting to increase. But at this point, it's not as easy as opening the gates. It's going to be a long, complicated recovery to rebuild because of the deep cuts that we made. The house position supports the financial model that the zoo needs to recover. We put a lot of thought into this. It'll sustain us until the vaccine is widely distributed. It'll help us rebuild our world-class zoo that we spent 42 years investing in. And most importantly, it'll get us back to that one-third, two-thirds relationship, that model that makes us a world-class zoo. So a lot of work's been done here. I have to applaud the staff and people at the zoo and people that have stepped up to support us. We have had to do some dispositioning of animals and, you know, just really some tough things. And we're hoping that we can get the support to rebuild. And we are looking at a 2 to 3 year recovery. As a lot of you run businesses and own businesses and have your main streets trying to rebuild, it's going to take a long time for us to bring back these resources and build back that workforce. I also would just like to take just a chance and thank Chair Hansen and Chair Ingridson for supporting the 2021 LCCMAR conservation projects and field work for the Minnesota Zoo. We have been able to maintain some of that work through the pandemic and just appreciate that support. So, Mr. Chair, that's a little bit of an update. I would take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Frawley. And I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Wozlawick here. I have to hop into another conference committee. But I would like, if I don't see any other questions, if you could maybe illuminate just your financial position more in terms of debt or lost revenue and then federal dollars. And I'm going to have to log off for about 15 minutes. So, Vice Chair Wozlawick, are you ready?
Yep, Mr. Frawley.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have our I thought we might go into some of the financials. I have Abigail Mosier, our CFO, that can kind of give you a financials overview per your request.
Ms. Mosier, I don't see her popping up here.
Mr. Chair and members.
Go ahead, Ms. Mosier.
Mr. Chair member, or Madam, excuse me, Madam Chair members, can you hear me?
Yep.
Thank you for the record. My name is Abigail Mosier. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Minnesota Zoo. And so as Director Frawley testified, you know, we're at a critical point. We had set a budget for the year anticipating that over the course of two biennia, we would see a reduction of about $30 million in our earned revenue, which is a significant sum. To give you an idea, our annual budget is around $30 million. So to see that loss of revenue over a four-year period is significant. Already in right at the beginning of the pandemic, we did see a loss in fiscal 20 of over $5 million in our earned revenue, and then it had anticipated an even bigger reduction for the current year. We've been cutting budgets, you know, like others left and right, and so we've reduced a substantial amount in our expenses, projected to be about $8 million in the current biennium, as well as worked through a significant portion of our cash on hand, several million there as well. And so, like you heard from others, we've been managing as best we can with reductions in spending as well as reducing our cash reserves. And we're also I'm very thankful for the additional appropriation we received over the summer that allowed us to try to balance our budget for the current year. But we're at a critical point in trying to move forward because we've made such significant reductions in our operations and our staffing, included a reduction in 48 positions, as well as many other positions affected by that. So in total, it's about 125 positions when you include delayed hiring, canceled hiring, pay reductions, and other impacts of making such significant cuts in a union environment. And so, you know, ultimately, that's reduced what we can offer to the public substantially. And we're at a point where we need additional resources in order to move forward. So the sooner we have certainty about what our budget looks like for the upcoming biennium, the sooner we can start rebuilding those experiences that people expect.
Thank you, Ms. Mosier. I see Representative Fisher has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that my first question will be for Ms. Mosier. I know that I heard that you folks are doing a lot of cuts where you can, and you've got a $30 million budget. How much of that is what I would call fixed costs? There's things that you really can't get rid of. I'm thinking of feeding the animals and that type, those type of things, your electricities, those kind of things. What percent of your budget is really fixed in those areas if we're going to keep the animals there?
Ms. Mosier?
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the question. It's significant. We have really high fixed costs, as you imagine. The care for the animals is roughly the same, whether the guests are there or not. We need to maintain a significant facility, over 250 developed acres in an even bigger campus. And they're really complex systems. It's really on the order of a small city in terms of maintaining our roads and our parking lots, our indoor and outdoor facilities. We maintain our own heat plant. It's really considerable. And most of that continues sort of regardless of whether we have guests. But we only achieve our mission and reach the public when we do have the guests. And so those additional costs on top of that are really what allow us to welcome people in for the daytime zoo guest experience, as well as our education and our event programs. So all of it is really important to generating the revenue that in a typical year comprises two-thirds of our income. But as you say, a goodly portion is fixed just to maintain the facility and to provide care for our animal collection.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Wozlik, and thank you, Ms. Mosher. Is when we're talking about significant fixed costs, are we talking like in the 75% range, 50% range? And then also, I have a question in terms of what type of reserves that you have right now. How much, what were they at? If you had reserves, what were they at, and what are you at now?
Ms. Mosher.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, members, thank you again for the question. You know, I apologize. It's kind of hard to answer the question on fixed costs because ultimately we are directed by statute to generate earned income to support the zoo. And so all of our expenses go either to maintaining the zoo as a facility with the animal collection, as well as welcoming guests and providing education and outreach programs. And so I don't know how to say that there's a portion that we wouldn't need, because if we're not spending the portion that generates revenue, then we're not generating the revenue. Therefore, we don't have sufficient resources to operate the zoo and keep it open. And that's exactly, you know, the point we were at last summer when we saw this $6 million appropriation to ensure we could balance our budget. And then we're sort of there again, heading into the next biennium. So from that perspective, all the dollars we spend really are to operate the zoo and to generate revenue. And those resources are needed in order to move forward. And I apologize, I think at this point, I forgot the second question.
The second question was about reserves, how much you have and where that was at before the pandemic happened.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So typically the zoo has targeted to maintain a reserve of $1.5 million as our quote unquote rainy day fund. That's less than 1 month of our annual operating costs. So it's not significant, but is important. And then beyond that, we do typically try to maintain additional cash reserves. And those are really what we invest in renewing exhibits and creating new exhibits and experiences for guests, because as in order to achieve our mission and to attract guests over time, we need to continually offer new experiences. And so we were at the beginning of the pandemic, we were actually relatively lucky to have cash reserves higher than typical because we were preparing to make several strategic investments with those dollars. We reduced much of that, actually all of that additional cash reserve in the spring before we received the additional appropriation over the summer. But we were able, through some actions on our part, including the drive-through zoo and some other additional expense cutting we were able to do, we were able to maintain that $1.5 million rainy day fund at the start of this fiscal year. But then, obviously, we are still working to balance that budget in the current year and looking ahead at the significant risks we still face for the upcoming biennium.
Representative Fisher, did you have any final question or?
Yes, final question would be to, I want to say thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Mosher. The last one I think would be for Mr. Farley, who was wondering, you had mentioned that the LCCMR provides funding for different projects that you have going on at the zoo. If we lose the one LCCMR bill funding that had projects in, what does that do for your projects that you're looking at for the coming year?
Mr. Frawley?
Madam Chair, members, our current LCCMR projects relate to interagency relationships with the Department of Transportation on research and studies around turtle populations in Minnesota and patterns. It's work that has been building and growing and turning up some great data to support how we manage and care for turtles in Minnesota, as well as, we have ongoing work and have invested in studying freshwater mussels here in Minnesota and working with the Department of Natural Resources and how we can successfully rear and populate and reintroduce freshwater mussels for healthier water systems throughout Minnesota. So, that work is ongoing. The staff's in place, the plans are in place, and so it would obviously disrupt those two projects.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I'd like to comment on and agree with Representative Fisher when we talk about fixed costs, especially when it comes to animals. Animal control and animal care just isn't a real fixed object. So, we're going to continue to keep our doors open even during the COVID. We understand that those things have to continue. Or the huge investment that the state of Minnesota has done would go to waste. So maybe I can ask Ms. Mosier with regards to, have you received federal funding so far this year? I believe there was like a $6 million appropriation last time.
Ms. Mosier?
Talk about that six, or was it $9 million? I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, thank you for the question. So we did receive, as I referenced earlier, $6 million over the summer from the state COVID Minnesota fund. It was state dollars and not federal dollars, and that's what allowed us to move forward into the beginning of the fiscal year with a budget. In terms of federal dollars, we have not received any during the pandemic. Thus far, we were not eligible as a public entity for the PPP loan and many of the other opportunities that other organizations could take advantage of. We are eligible for a shuttered venue grant, which is a program that was created through the Small Business Administration as part of the second and third stimulus bills. They just opened applications about a week or two ago now, and we did make an application. According to the formula, we may be eligible for up to $7 million through that grant opportunity. Unfortunately, there's widespread expectation that the program will run short of funds, similar to PPP and other programs. And so while certainly we've made our best attempt at an application, we are sitting and waiting with, I believe, about 17,000 organizations applied in the first 24 hours, and then additional organizations have applied beyond that. So the expectation is the money will run short, and we're unclear of where we'll fall within that. Also, the federal legislation set up priority categories. We are not in the first two priority categories. We, like most museums and zoos and other entities, would fall into the third category, and they're required by law to allocate to the first two categories first. So the best information we have available is an email from the SBA last night that said they anticipate beginning to award to the first two categories at the end of May. So one of the challenges is we would not know likely within the time of the legislative session what those dollars would be, if any.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, follow up.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, yep, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Megan. Knowing John, I'm sure he's going to do what he can to push those applications from the bottom all the way up to the top when it comes to that. I'm just wondering, of the $2.6 billion of federal discretionary money that's coming available, are you asking for any of those dollars? Either Mr. Frawley or Ms. Mosier would like to answer that, please.
Mr. Frawley, you want to take that one?
I think Ms. Mosher's been working on that project.
Okay, Ms. Mosher.
Madam Chair and members, we did participate in the executive branch process for indicating a need or a particular sort of whether we were eligible for different aspects of that money. I don't believe, I don't have updated information. I don't believe that process has concluded, so I can't speak to where that would lead.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you have any other questions?
No other questions, Madam Chair, but I would just like to say that, you know, as you can see, and I appreciate the testimony from both of you with regards to the zoo, that we have a basically a flat rate. We haven't raised or lowered the budget. However, with my target, it's a little tougher to handle out handling the dollars, but I'm looking forward to working with the with you and the House members, along with our committee, to hopefully move forward with this and make sure that we keep the jewel that we have down there. I mean, it's just a beautiful place to visit. So thank you all.
Any other questions for the zoo? Not seeing any hands go up. I see Representative Hansen is back, so I will turn the virtual gavel back over to him.
You were doing a great job. I was going to let you keep going there. Ms. Nash, LCCMR.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Becca Nash. I'm the director of the LCCMR, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to say a few words about Senate File 959, Articles 3 and 4. Which cover the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund funding for our 2020 and 2021 rounds of funding. As nonpartisan staff to the LCCMR, we don't typically take positions on bills, so my comments today will be limited to some background and differences between the bills in comparison to the LCCMR's recommendations. As you know, the LCCMR is a 17-member joint commission responsible for making recommendations to the legislature and how the state's constitutionally dedicated Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund dollars are appropriated, and then for conducting oversight of those approved projects and associated expenditures. LCCMR's recommendations typically result from a multi-stage competitive process, starting with written applications submitted by applicants across the state. After a thorough vetting process, the top proposals are selected and put into bill form, which requires approval by at least 12 of our 17 members, and then presented to the legislature for your consideration. The 2020 process did not receive the required 12 votes, so came to you last year as tentative recommendations. Agreement was not reached by the legislature last year on this package. If not signed into law by June 30th of this year, those funds cannot be appropriated and will instead be returned to the corpus of the fund. I'm therefore pleased to see the 2020 funding included here in Article 3 and to see signs of progress between the House and the Senate in terms of reaching an agreement. The 2021 process resulted in a unanimous support from the LCCMR. Likewise, I'm happy to see the 2021 recommendations included here in Article 4, almost exactly as LCCMR recommended, with two changes that I can provide some comments on. In Article 3, the 2020 RFP, which is fiscal year 21 funds, as compared to the tentative recommendations that came from the LCCMR, the Senate's bill deletes 12, reduces 1, and increases the amount of funding to one of the tentatively recommended projects. It also adds 13 new projects, and 3 of those new projects appear to be projects previously recommended by the LCCMR or funded with the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. As compared to the LCCMR recommendations, the House version of the bill modifies one project and increases funding to 4 of the tentative recommendations. It also adds 5 projects, all of which appear to be for projects previously recommended by the LCCMR or funded with the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Both the House and the Senate use a transfer of $2.7 million from the Sauk River Dam project in making these additions. The LCCMR voted unanimously to have the legislature repurpose those funds that didn't specify how they should be repurposed. The Senate also amended language for a past Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund appropriations to the DNR for the Point Pine Forest SNA acquisition. The new language allows for any funds remaining and not needed for the acquisition to be available as a grant to the Duluth Airport Authority to protect the scientific and natural area by relocating an airport runway. The House version of the bill includes rider language requiring recipients of the 2020 appropriations who are children's service providers to perform background checks on employees, contractors, and volunteers who may have access to children. The commission did vote to ask the legislature to take action on this issue. We didn't specify what the action would look like or how it would be implemented, though this was language that we looked at. You'll see that the Senate took a slightly different approach to this language in Article 4. Both the House and Senate also extended the end dates of all the projects in the 2020 bill to account for the year that has passed since the projects were recommended. For Article 4, which is the 2021s, the Senate made no changes to the projects. What you see is as recommended by the LCCMR. The Senate did include the child protection background check language. It appears to be the same language, but it is in statute and it is effective as of July 2022. The House made no changes to the LCCMR recommendations, but did add on an additional project using repurposed funds that are being returned to the trust fund at the conclusion of the projects and that would otherwise expire June 30th of this year. And again, that new project appears to be a continuation of a project previously funded with the trust fund. And then again, in the House version of the bill, you'll see that the House included the rider language, making the 2021 projects subject to the child protection background check requirement, basically effective immediately. Both House and Senate also included COVID-related extensions for projects expiring in 2021, which we appreciate, as well as the project managers. I think that's it for me, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and big shout out to Becca Nash as our Director of Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources. She does an excellent job, as well as the staff. They're just absolutely wonderful to work with that she's been on there and the years before that as well. So I understand should the bill not pass, the 2020 LCCMR bill, that goes back into the corpus. What happens to that money then? It can be reappropriated. Is that correct, Ms. Nash?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the money does return to the corpus of the trust fund, and then it, as other money in the trust fund is invested and sits and receives interest year after year, but we are limited to using up to 5.5% of the value of the fund for any given biennium. So that money would go away and then it would just, as I suppose, count towards the calculation for next year, but it wouldn't be available for appropriation specifically.
And that Mr. Chair?
Mayor Ingebrigtsen.
And that appropriation is, I think, the smaller of the two, the 60, low 60s, and I believe the 2021 will refer to the newest one, is nearly 70, if I'm not mistaken, without looking at the spreadsheet. So there would be a very significant amount available. And that's really unfortunate, members. And I know, Ms. Nash, you don't want to get involved in the haggles that we have here. And it's really unfortunate, frankly, that we didn't get it done last year. However, as you well know, there was not unanimous agreement on the 2020, unlike this year's appropriation, which there was unanimous. So it wasn't just a, you know, like it has been in the past, if I might say, a slam dunk moving forward. And it's really unfortunate that we didn't do that for whatever reason, whatever held it up. And we all know, I guess, what held it up, but that's really unfortunate. But again, thank you for your work, and I hope that we can make this happen moving forward. I know there's a lot of projects out there, a lot of folks are watching, and they're ready to go. As we say, they're shovel ready. You know, I haven't heard that shovel ready thing for a little while, so it's kind of nice to be able to talk about putting the shovel in the ground here. So thank you so much for what you do and for the testimony.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ingebrigtsen really stole my thunder, but I would just quickly ask Director Nash if there was any additional impacts that this conference committee should be aware of under the circumstances that we're discussing.
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, thanks for asking that question. I think, the vast majority of the funding in this bill for Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund is directed at work being done to protect, conserve, preserve, and enhance Minnesota's environment. Less than 1.2% of the funds is going towards operating funds. So this is all work that is being done to actively protect our environment. So any sort of holdup, I think we worry about the work that's not being done. There are some critical issues that are addressed in these bills. Some of the highlights that we have heard about are the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center, a very popular project that we have funded for several years now, working on invasive species affecting both agricultural systems and natural systems. This is it for funding for them. If they don't receive this funding, they don't have any more to work on. So they do critical work on Palmer amaranth, emerald ash borer, a whole host of species. We also know that any sort of restoration projects, again, on the groundwork being done, we've been told that when you miss a year of restoration or invasive species control, it takes 3 to 4 years to catch up. So it's not just the loss of a year, there's a cumulative effect here. It is a big issue if not funded. We also know that there are 745 jobs that would be funded with the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And we know that there are about 120 different, or it's about 70 different organizations receiving those funds.
Representative Heinzman, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for a chance to follow up. Director Nash, in addition to some of the things you're just mentioning, we've, of course, faced a number of challenges as a lot of environment natural resource related projects, not just in the LCCMR, but in other subject areas, were delayed due to the governor's orders and other challenges as it relates to COVID and such. Do you foresee with the current package of projects, are you hearing from those folks that are developing those plans and were approved through the latest round of recommendations that were ready to go and that those projects could be fully moving forward in this next cycle, or are you hearing that there would be continued delays?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Heinzman, we have heard that some projects may need to shift funding to adapt to the new environment as best they can, but the overwhelming sense that we hear from people is that they are ready to work, they are eager to work, they are just waiting for funding.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate that. Thank you, Director Nash. One final question. Is there anything in the LCCMR bill that would raise a cost of anything over $500 without legislative input? Just a final question that had kind of popped up on my radar.
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question. Could you repeat it, please?
Representative Heinzman.
Yeah, so just something that popped up on my radar is is there anything in the LCCMR bill that would raise a cost of anything over $500 without legislative input? I'm assuming that those things are fixed, but I just wanted to confirm that.
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not quite understanding the question. The all the appropriations would need to be approved by the legislature, and then there are minor shifts within budgets that would be allowed, and if they are significant, we as staff always bump those up to the full commission to consider, but the amount of funding going to each group for each project is would be fixed in law.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Nash. It was just a question that had been on my mind, and I had wondered. I thought I knew the answer, but I appreciate the clarification.
Before Representative Fisher, Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you have a follow-up to previous, or
I do.
Is that a new hand?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And first of all, thank you to Representative Heintzman to remind us about last year and how COVID played a huge role in all of our areas of government. I mean, the shutdown was devastating on everything, and it wasn't any different for the folks out there that were doing projects. You wouldn't think that was the case because most of these projects are outdoor, but nevertheless, they still were very cautious, and those things didn't move forward. I don't think, and Chair Hansen, maybe you can help me with this, or maybe staff can, but of the $2.5 billion worth of federal discretionary money, I don't think LCCMR would qualify that, probably not legacy either, because those are funded with sales tax. I'm just thinking out loud here. I don't think there's a need for them to do any asking for those dollars. That seemed to be a large secret, by the way, as to how we're going to how the administration is going to funnel that money out. But I don't think maybe the question is better answered to you or asked to you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if that's if they can even do that?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think because we're kind of unique funding, it in general, it's probably not available. But we did ask there. You may remember this recommended appropriation for COVID research that was on wastewater treatment. I think Ms. Nash could correct me if I'm wrong, but it was about $600,000. So that may be something that could be funded because it's direct research, it's been vetted, and that would provide for, I think that could be something. But Ms. Nash, if you may want to highlight that particular one or any other COVID research one.
Mr. Chair, yes, correct. There was a COVID-related water project. I'm just trying to also think about any other federal funds. I know that we have heard, some of our projects are receiving federal match dollars, and we have heard that some have received the match, others that haven't received their match. And then I would also say that I think with the first round of COVID relief dollars that came from the federal government, we were able to get some costs reimbursed related to moving our operations remotely. So we had to buy a couple more computers for staff to be working at home, and we did get those costs reimbursed, but they were quite minor, and it was our current budget, not the budget that is before you today.
And Ms. Nash, if the 2020, what we call the 2020 bill, was not approved, our operating on July 1st, would we have to, if we don't get that appropriation, would we have to stop the RFP and the vetting process for the subsequent year if we go past June 30th without that appropriation?
Mr. Chair, correct. If our operating budget is included in the 2021 bill, and if that does not pass, the LCCMR actually does not have any reserve. So we might be able to reach out to the LCC and see if we could receive some of their reserve, but that would have to be, we'd be in competition for that with other joint offices. So LCCMR does not have reserves. And then also very importantly, the DNR grants staff, which helps us with our non-state recipients, and they are the ones that are processing all the reimbursement requests. They also do not have funds. And so what concerns me about that is not only that they're not providing the technical assistance to our grantees, but they might not be there to provide reimbursement for costs that have already been incurred by our recipients.
So those grant recipients would have to eat those costs?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Nash, for the presentation. The question I have is on the what we call the 2020 LCCMR bill. Is I noticed there's quite a bit of money that was going to you for the invasive terrestrial work that's going on. I know that in the past, when different parts of the U.S. doing a lot of research, if they get a gap in funding, they start losing the people that are doing that work, and sometimes they have to restart projects or the projects end, and it takes a long time to find qualified people to come back in. Do you know what the impact would be in this area if that funding did not come through? Would we be in that same situation that we would lose a lot of work or a lot of the people that are working that have got this expertise?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, indeed that's part of the benefit of the center is that they are paying, providing funding, attracting talent to work on these critical issues. Oftentimes they're hiring grad students or postdocs, and if they miss that window to apply for people, it's at least another year out until they can get their feet up off the ground. And it's not just a matter of turning on and off a spigot. You know, there's a substantial startup costs again that would time and cost that would be needed in order to get things running.
President Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Nash. I appreciate that clarity there. So it's pretty critical. If we lose that, we lose at the U. We lose the people who are doing that work, and it would take a while before it would start up again. And with the threat that we have with the invasive species, whether it's in the agriculture or in our aquatic areas, in our lakes and our rivers, that could cause some significant problems as going in the future. So thank you for letting us know what the consequences are.
Ms. Nash, just to be clear, the 62+ million that's in 2020, if we roll past June 30th without that being appropriated, it's not that there's $62 million left. It's that that goes into the corpus and then it adds to the interest. So maybe in the next round, there's $1 or $2 million more that's generated to interest. So that roughly $60 million of projects would be lost. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I appreciate, maybe Ms. Nash, if you could just confirm that.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I appreciate the movement in the Senate in the side-by-side removing the wastewater treatment, which was the appropriation that caused consternation. And as Ms. Nash noted, there are previously funded projects in the Senate bill. It seems like there should be an ability there on the content where we can find compromise on the amounts and what they could be appropriated to. We're really, that $62 million, we're probably talking about $4 million that we could find a way, a path out of this conundrum. I'm very concerned about both the 20 and the 2021. We have vehicles on the floor of the House. If we could find compromise and if we run into a train wreck here at the end, of May 17th or June 30th, that we find some way of saving these recommendations. I appreciate the progress, the changes you've made. It's my understanding that the clean car rulemaking, which we can talk about when we get to PCA, is still the holdup, but I would hope that we could set these free at some point so that we can demonstrate to Minnesotans that we can follow through on these important investments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, at this point, this is the only bill that I'm moving forward and I'm going to support. So I think it's going to take some compromise. We've been talking about this now for, I'm sure it's almost 2 years, and there's been no movement at all from the administration. So I guess, it feels like maybe the House is putting the onus on the Senate for for not moving on this, but for such a small part of state government overall, I would hate to see us have to return these dollars back to the corpus. But if the governor doesn't come along with us and at least do something. I mean, I never got a response from the governor's administration last year and a half at all. Apparently, he's not real serious about getting these budgets funded. So, but this right now, at this point, this is the only bill that I'm interested in. Members should also know that those that are relatively new, I'm not near as old as experienced as a Representative Hansen with regards to being in the legislature, but as he knows, up until 2006, the LCCMR bills were always included in the environmental finance budget. So this is nothing new. It's fairly new for recently, but you know, there was some criticism of adding that to the budget this year, but again, it's nothing that has been out of the ordinary. So, but I hope we come together. I really do. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to moving these things forward, and it's going to take some compromise. And I think we all know where that's going to be from. So, but we'll ask those questions when the commissioner comes forward. Thank you,
Senator Ingebrigtsen. I think Senator Tomassoni had a question, and I'm just want to make sure I get him in. Senator Tomassoni.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. For people who don't know what the LCCMR is, it's a very, very hardworking commission in the legislature that's made up of legislators and citizens. And we actually go through weeks and weeks and weeks of vetting projects and coming together on recommendations to the legislature. And the people that present the projects, they do a real lot of work also. And I'm hoping that both of you chairs can figure out a way to get this done. And I understand what's going on. And I think that leaving the money on the table would be a mistake. But at the same time, I want to make sure that we get a package out that everybody can live with. There's a compromise that's being sought also, because one of the things we do in the legislature is we work out issues and we come to the middle. And if there's a way to compromise on this particular bill and compromise on the issues that is concerned to Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think that we got to find that bill, because there's been way too much work put into the bill itself, not only by the legislators, by the staff, but by people that presented the bills and the people that they hired to come up with the presentations that they came up with and the projects that they came up with. So I'm hoping that we can get to a point where we can make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nash, and extend our thanks to the staff for their work, and hopefully we can make progress. Mr. Jashke.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you. John Jashke, Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and also with me on the Zoom call here is Assistant Director Angie Becker-Kadelka. So we'll be here for questions today and for the duration of your committee's work. I'll keep my remarks fairly briefly. We did provide the committee a letter with some of the points that we thought were most important to your deliberations, and I'll quickly review that and then stand for any questions as well. Mr. Chairman, members, as indicated in our letter, there's a couple of key policy provisions that are from the governor's initiative, and two of them are in the House bill, the Soil Health Program and the Water Storage Treatment Program. We believe those are critical and very practical ways to accomplish some of our conservation needs, including adaptation for the climate changes that we're seeing. We support the provision in the House on the soil health piece, And we also, frankly, I think can work with either version of the water storage and treatment piece and actually provided some suggestions on that one particular item in attachment to our letter. So you can take a look at that. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for that. We also support the budget neutral item regarding easement stewardship. We have, 6,000 some conservation easements across the entire state, and there are situations where a little bit of flexibility on making sure those are well managed, particularly some structural things that may need attention are allowed. Again, it's a budget neutral provision for an existing dedicated account. We also do support to the pollinator issue that came up earlier when Ms. Pratt was testifying. The Lost Legumes program was started and with a great deal of success and interest, and this allows people to bring their own money with a little bit of state money to do additional, on the ground, get some pollinator habitat established and keep parts of the state that have some concerns with the losses of those particular species. We also support the Soil Water Conservation District Supervisor Compensation. That's just a catch-up provision that's in both bills, or both provisions that are in the Senate and the House. And on the Senate side, Ms. Pratt also mentioned the Clean Water 404 assumption study. An extension of that would be very helpful to make sure we do our work as well as we can. Again, no additional resources are needed there. On to the budget, Mr. Chairman and members, obviously the House position is much more like and supporting the governor's recommendations. So that's, of course, where we're headed with our suggestions as well. The Senate reductions are a concern, and we pointed that out in our letter. Our money that we get from the legislature is passed on in great extent to local governments. 80-some percent of our funding goes out the door to local governments for their conservation work, and that's a very effective business model for getting conservation accomplished. One additional provision that we noted was added on the Senate floor regarding a carve-out for subsurface sewage treatment systems under the block grants that go to counties. As noted in our letter, we think that that isn't warranted or needed, frankly, because there's a provision for that already in the legacy amendment that has been there for several years under the MPCA's appropriations. And then finally, I'll just mention, of course, the situation that we're in with the Soil Water Conservation District funding. All of you know and have supported Soil Water Conservation District is a key component of getting our conservation, our clean water, our habitat work done at that local level, working with private landowners on their property. There are provisions in this bill, also some provisions in a legacy bill, and I know there was also some considerations at some point in the past, maybe still continuing in the tax bill, so we want to pay attention to all those things, and we're ready to work with you and the conferees of this committee and any other ones that are working to accomplish this really, really important provision for state funding for the Soil Water Conservation District work. And I will stand for questions. Ms. Nash covered the Environmental Outreach Resources Trust Fund components, so I'll leave her comments and as similar to ours. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Jaskie, for your presentation and for the great work Bowser does. You mentioned the Lawns to Legumes program, and thank you for implementing an amazing, it's been sort of a big success story. A lot of appetite in Minnesota to transform traditional lawns and to support our declining pollinator population. I'm wondering what happens to the program if we don't end up getting a bill.
Mr. Jaskie.
And Mr. Chairman and members, and Representative Morrison, if there is no bill, I suppose then there is no program. The original funding for this came from an LCCMR appropriation, and that's been expended, so the program basically would cease to exist without any funding or policy to support it.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a bit of a rhetorical question, but I think the point I'm trying to make will be understood. What does Lawns to Legumes or Bowser have to do with the Clean Cars rulemaking?
Chairman, and Representative Morrison, there is no connection of our agency to that rulemaking effort the MPCA is responsible for.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Jaschke, the federal funds, I think you'd provided us earlier with, there were some COVID costs like $600K or so. Could you maybe highlight things that may be eligible for federal funding with your agency?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Chairman and members. We do a lot of work with federal funding, but it's done through an indirect path because most of that funding goes directly to landowners, and then we line up our state resources and local support for that through that direct federal funding that goes to landowners. We do get a few EPA grants and things like that, and that's what Ms. Pratt talked about with that one particular 404 appropriation, because we were able to use to get some additional federal money for that. But to your general point, we do not have access to or a path to any federal, COVID relief type funding. Our estimate was that we shared with you, Ms. Chairman, you shared with anyone else who's interested, was that we had about $595,000 of COVID related costs during the past year plus. We don't have a mechanism to get reimbursed or for those costs, but they had to do with, the usual things of running an organization. And also we had extra costs. Some of our field work, contractors and things were delayed. We had to have people travel singularly in vehicles. We had to have, only certain authorizations for stay overnight and things like that. So we can get you a longer list if you'd like to see that. But Mr. Chairman, that was our first estimate.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, maybe that's something that we can highlight as federal money. It seems to be cold. Every little bit helps. My concern is if we have federal, let's say, CREP dollars coming in, how do you provide the technical assistance to get those projects in the ground?
Sure. Mr. Chair. We can certainly look at that, but Mr. Jaschke, I do have one question.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Mr. Jaschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jaschke, it was asked earlier if Bowser had anything to do with clean cars, climate change, whatever that goes with that. And you said no, but you do have access and do visit with other commissioners throughout this budget cycle, I'm assuming. Is that correct?
Mr. Jaschke.
Mr. Chair and Senator Wilson, yes, the administration works together on obviously not only the budget, but other policies as well. And the governor has appointed the executive order, of agencies to support the climate work.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No more, thanks. Just want to make that clear, thanks.
So, just to be clear, so if there's not a repeal of the authority for the clean car rulemaking coming out of this conference committee, then the budgets for Bowser, the Minnesota Zoo, the LCCMR, the Conservation Corps, the Science Museum, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the MPCA, and the DNR will not happen unless we accede to the Senate position. Is that correct, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Representative Hansen, that's exactly correct. And that's one area, only one small area in this whole budget. So if the administration can't at least talk to me or talk to us with regards to that, then I guess I refuse to be the heavy with regards to the budget not moving forward when I get no commitment whatsoever over basically $22,000. That's exactly what it would stop, what the agency would save if that were to go away. So that seems pretty petty to me. And I think we can, if they have some discussions with themselves and get back to me, I think we can move forward. But it's going to have to be with that understanding.
Any other questions for Mr. Jaschke? Thank you, Mr. Jaschke, for your work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We'll be around anytime you have any questions or need some ideas or input.
And Mr. Commissioner Stroman, Department of Natural Resources.
Good. Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I may be having an issue with my video. Can you see me?
We can see Minnesota Department of Natural Resources logo.
That's what I thought.
And a lake, and a beautiful Lake Superior scene.
Yes. Okay, there we go.
You're there. Here we go.
There we go. My camera setting switched on me. I apologize for that. So I will say good morning again. I'm Sarah Stroman. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and I am joined this morning by Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer. We're very pleased to have the opportunity to be here this morning, and we're looking forward to working with the conference committee to finalize the Omnibus Environment Bill. We all know that Minnesotans are enjoying our natural resources in numbers like we haven't seen for a long time. They are experiencing not only the diverse recreation opportunities that our state offers, but also the health benefits that come with spending time outdoors. Minnesotans are able to enjoy these benefits because our state has a long tradition of investing in natural resources and outdoor recreation. And the truth is, we are not keeping up with those investments. We have aging infrastructure and service delivery that cannot keep pace with changing public expectations and the overall use. Our primary objective with this budget is to make sure that we can continue to meet Minnesotans' expectations. To that end, we are concerned by the $9.8 million general fund reduction made to the DNR budget in the Senate bill. The Senate's approach both makes cuts to some programs and in other cases shifts spending to dedicated funds. These dedicated funds already suffer from structural issues, and this means that the spending proposed cannot be sustained. We believe Minnesota needs a long-term solution to natural resources and outdoor funding rather than this reduction in opportunity and service at the very time they are most using these resources. Our letter that we sent to the conference committee details the specific impacts of these shifts and cuts to our programs related to water management, forest management, aquatic invasive species, minerals research, state parks and recreation areas, as well as enforcement. So I'm not going to go into the details, but would be happy to answer any questions about that. Also, as proposed in the governor's budget, we believe that investments that continue to connect Minnesotans to the outdoors through investments in state park and recreation areas, as well as water recreation, are critical. The House does include these investments with some differences from the governor's proposals. The Senate bill does not. Modernizing the RIM critical habitat dollars so we can efficiently and effectively invest those dollars in critical habitat is another important provision of the governor's budget. We want to thank both the House and the Senate for including this provision. We do support a framework that keeps funds in one habitat pot rather than designating spending by license plate image. The places that we acquire and manage for critical habitat really serve multiple benefits. And so adding spending designations based on plate image undercuts the efficiency we are actually seeking with the modernization changes. Investments in chronic wasting disease. There is an increased importance and urgency to these investments given the recent discovery of a CWD positive deer at a farm facility in Beltrami County. That's a significant geographic jump in the disease, and it's going to mean that we need to do some critical surveillance in that Beltrami County area in order to make sure that we don't see the disease in the wild in the heart of deer country and in the heart of communities that rely on deer hunters. In the area of public safety, the state has called upon DNR conservation officers to provide public safety assistance with an unprecedented frequency and scale over the past year plus. It is essential that General Fund reimburse this work. We cannot use dedicated funding sources such as the Game and Fish Fund to pay for general public safety activities. And we appreciate both the House and Senate's commitment and support to meeting these urgent fiscal needs. With our operations funding, I will just note again, details on are in our letter, but it is important that we are funded for legal fees, cybersecurity, and our operating adjustments. These are expenses that the agency incurs, and without dollars allocated, we realize that in terms of a reduction in programs and services. I also want to spend a moment on the LCCMR and take a moment to urge the conference committee to develop a resolution on the LCCMR recommendations in this bill, both the 2020 and 2021 bills. As Director Nash stated, and as we shared in a March 3rd letter to the LCCMR chairs, because there was not a 2020 bill passed, either during the regular or special sessions, we did not receive the our annual appropriation to administer the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund grants for fiscal year 21. This is the sole source of funding for the work that we do on these grants. And so in order to not disrupt the work of all of the grantees who rely on those funds, we have been temporarily using other operating funds to pay those costs, and then assuming we could repay those funds when we got the LCCMR bill passed. We have reached the end of our option to do that, and so we are now at the point without a new appropriation, we will be unable to continue our administrative work on the 72 grants that are currently open. And then, of course, as Director Nash discussed and as this conference committee has already discussed, all of the good work that the LCCMR funds and the number of project proposers and funding recipients that do environmental work on behalf of the Minnesotans and to benefit our state. I just want to spend a moment on policy. We're extremely pleased that the Senate and the House bills include both the 2020 and 2021 lands bills and the DNR's 2020 and 2021 policy bills. And I will just say that while much of our agency policy language appears technical, it is programmatically important. And we urge the conference committee to move forward with those items of agreement soon so we can get those moving forward. And the letter that we provided to the committee outlines a number of policy provisions in both the House and Senate bills that are of some concern we hope to resolve through this conference committee process. I'll let the letter stand on its own for those. And at this point, Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner Meyer and I would be happy to take any questions. And again, we thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a bunch of questions. So I'm going to go with Representative Woslawick, and then Fisher, and then Heinzman. So
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. I just wanted to ask a question. I know there's been some consternation around some provisions, some policy provisions, and I wanted to just clarify with the agency, the transfer of the authority, the oversight of the deep farming to the DNR. Can you speak to what the agency's position is on that?
Commissioner Stroman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative. I think for quite some time, we have been working closely with the Board of Animal Health to try to more effectively match up where our authorities and their authorities sort of meet up and we work together. We've done that through memorandum of understanding. What I will say, quite frankly, is with this latest discovery, I think we're at the point where we need to make sure that we are doing something different to limit the spread. And so what I would say our position is if that transfer does come out of the conference committee, we would just want to make sure it's funded. Our concern with it would be to make sure that it does not subtract from the really important management work that we do on wild deer.
Representative Woslawick.
That was my question for now, so thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Stroman, thank you for being here today. A couple of quick questions. First one is, if there is no budget approved, what happens on July 1st with the programs that the DNR runs?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if as a state agency, if we do not have a budget for the fiscal year, we don't operate.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we don't operate, that means all state parks would be closed?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, yes.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other question I had is, I noticed that there was a Senate reduction for groundwater management areas and some things proposed in that area. My question is if that were to occur, how does that impact the groundwater management work areas, particularly the work that's going on in the East Metro areas?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher, thank you for that question. As we laid out in our letter to the committee, we are concerned with the reduction to water management programs, including the groundwater management area work that we do. And the reality is, with reduced funding, we can provide reduced service and reduced technical assistance to communities who are needing that assistance to make good decisions about water use. And so we will see a reduction in our ability to do research and to provide technical assistance to a variety of communities, including those in the East Metro, and also our efforts to promote water conservation.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Stroman, I'm glad you're here. Thank you for presenting today. My question is around probably one of the pie charts we saw earlier in session that broke down the federal dollars that the agency uses for various projects around the state. Could you just quick give a overview of, and some of the numbers, so we have a better idea what that looks like and what it might take to make sure that we continue to capture those dollars for use in Minnesota?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman, I am trying to quickly put my fingers on that pie chart so that we can recreate that information. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Meyer has been able to do that more quickly than I have.
Commissioner Meyer. It's a tech race right now.
Mr. Chairman, members, I do have the slide I believe Representative Heintzman is speaking of. If I have the authority to share my screen, I will try to do that right now. Did that show up, or does that show up at all?
It's still you, Commissioner.
All right.
Mr. Schirmeier?
Now I have it. So, Mr. Chairman, members, you should be seeing a slide now titled FY 2021 Budget by Fund. Representative Heintzman, if this is the slide you were talking about, you can see that there's $72.8 million of federal funding there, about 5% of our total revenues. This is based upon expenditures, but that federal funding does come in from many different levels, including matches on Dingell, Johnson, Wallop, Perot, sales tax, excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment. That's included in that number as well. So we need to continue to do what we can to ensure those matches come in, and we are doing whatever we can to do that. So we're very fortunate as Minnesota can capture pretty much our full allocation of those revenues. Some other states don't have the match to be able to do that.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that reminder. I was trying to recall how much federal money comes into the DNR over the course of the biennium, and you know, $72 million is significant. I hope that the challenges we faced in the last year that prevented a lot of the ongoing projects. I understand that the costs were still there, but the projects like fish stocking and other things were either delayed or canceled. So I'm really optimistic that this next year will be different and we'll see those things continue through the biennium and we'll get this budget done. Thank you.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Stroman, for your presentation and for all your work this year. You and I have talked in the past about how one of the silver linings of the pandemic has been that Minnesotans and their families have kind of re-engaged in our natural world, and even better, in some cases, have engaged for the first time. So I assume that we're anticipating continued growth this summer because there's all of this pent-up need to get out and to do things. And after establishing some habits over the last year, people are wanting to get out. So I'm just trying to get my brain around that again, that if the bill isn't done, our state parks will be closed in July. Is that right?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrison, like any state agency, we have to have a budget to operate. So if there isn't a budget, we can't operate facilities that we manage.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Stroman. That is that would be devastating. I have one other question. I noticed the Senate position decreases general fund appropriations in many cases and uses money from other funds. I'm wondering if you could explain, if you or Assistant Commissioner Meyer maybe know what the Game and Fish Fund, for example, are for and how much money is in it. And the Heritage Enhancement Fund is another one I'm interested in.
Commissioner Stroman or Assistant Commissioner Meyer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I can start, and then if Assistant Commissioner Meyer wants to fill in additional details. So each of those dedicated funds has specific purposes, right? So the Game and Fish Fund, clearly we spend on fish and game management. Part of what the Senate proposal does is it shifts, for example, our chronic wasting disease work to from general fund, takes away that last remaining general fund that supports our Fish and Wildlife Division's chronic wasting disease work and shifts it to general fund. Well, that work is appropriate for that dedicated fund in that particular case. One of the things I think you've all heard us talk about is the long-term structural deficit of the Game and Fish Fund. And while we're excited that so many Minnesotans have gotten out this year and bought their fishing licenses and their hunting licenses, that does not erase long-term declines over the past number of years that really lead us to be concerned about the long-term sustainability of that fund. So shifting, and that's the case with many of our dedicated funds, right? That's why we're here proposing an increase in the watercraft registration fees so that we can reinvest those dollars into our water recreation infrastructure. That fund is not healthy enough to sustain, even maintaining the current amount of maintenance we do, much less additional investments. And so, while we appreciate the Senate spending dollars so we can continue to deliver those programs, it's still a short-term solution because those funds cannot sustain that kind of spending for much longer. And I think Assistant Commissioner Meyer does have some additional information to add to the response. So I'd ask if he could add to my response.
Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to show one more quick slide here, if I may. That I should have probably shared this earlier. This is a historical slide that shows our expenditures by fund for the past 12 years. And if you look at the budget, when we had budget problems back in FY12, we lost substantial amount of general fund revenue. This black line here on the bottom is our general fund revenue. One of our major concerns outlined in that letter is the shifts from the general fund to other dedicated sources, notwithstanding them, their original purposes, may take us 4 or 5 bienniums to recover from. As you can see, it took us from FY12 to FY20 to build back up our general fund that we had seen in FY8-9. So it's not that we're supportive or we appreciate the fact that general fund reductions are backfilled with other accounts, but that struggle to get those general fund dollars back is really what we'll face. if that were to take place. So that's this graphic really shows those concerns. Mr. Chairman, I can send these slides to the conference committee members if they are interested. So thank you. I will stop there.
And I think Commissioner Meyer and Commissioner Stroman, maybe with Mr. Hagemeyer and Mr. Stanley, on how much there are in those various funds available, what the reserves are, would be helpful to get to the conference committee. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be, first of all, to Deputy Commissioner Meyer. During that 2011 and 12, and I was chair of this committee during that devastating $5.6 billion deficit that we had to address. And it appears that the money has been, the general fund money has been at least increasing. It shows a little dip here lately. However, it's still increasing. During that time, I would expect that the federal money that we talked about, the Pittman-Roberts money and all that, continued to grow. I see it's up to 72 some million. I don't remember what that was in 2011. Do you remember what that was in 2011?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Meyer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, I do not have the specific numbers in front of me. I can get that for you. And just that federal number includes all federal funds. It's not just for the Pittman-Roberts and Dingell-Johnson dollars. So there would be other components in there, such as federal boat water safety grants and LAWCON and things like that that are in there as well. We can certainly describe to you. I can get you an Excel spreadsheet that would show those numbers if you're interested.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I would be interested in that. I'd like to see what the growth was there. I think so the committee has an idea that the general fund has always been discussed and attacked, I guess, by those in the environmental community. They never take into consideration the amount of money from LCCMR or the amount of money from Legacy or gifts that are donated to the state of Minnesota. They don't ever figure that into the expenditures in the environment, and it's always kind of amazed me. So I would love to see that. My other question, Mr. Chair, if I could, to the commissioner.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would ask the fact that the governor has the authority to appropriate the $2.5 billion. Have you got any idea whether the governor is intending on doing any of that with regards to COVID-related expenditures?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, with respect to the COVID dollars that are upcoming available, we are still waiting for guidance from the federal government on the eligible uses and restrictions or other pieces that might be related to those funds. We have not yet received that guidance. So, unfortunately, I don't have more information to share with you today.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, the governor, I think, still has the opportunity to appropriate other dollars that have come in. But I'm just wondering, have you kept a tally of everything, and do you know what that tally is that you would ask the governor for?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, again, what we would ask for is going to be dependent on the federal guidelines and what is actually eligible. So certainly we have an idea of where we sustain COVID impacts and those kinds of things, but we cannot say what we would ask for until we know what's eligible.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a belaboring question here. So as commissioner, I'm sure you're having, real close discussions with the governor. Do you have any idea when this is going to be, this kind of information is going to be released I guess, probably not only Minnesota, but the other states?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't have an answer to that question.
Senator Ingebrigtsen? Commissioner Stroman, maybe to follow up on that, do you have an estimate of lost revenue from the campgrounds during the past year due to COVID for camping?
Mr. Chair, we can get the committee the information we do have related to campaign revenue. I will just say I will have to make sure it's all netted out. You know, we had an increase in state park vehicle permit sales. We had a decrease in camping revenue. And so we can certainly share those numbers as we have them at this point.
And then another specific line item is the Verso paper mill timber leases, if you could maybe highlight that of COVID-related. Explain that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and both the Senate and the House have looked at timber relief legislation related to the closure of the Verso paper mill and the impacts felt throughout the timber industry as a result of that. And so I believe that you would have our fiscal notes as those bills were presented going through that would describe the costs, both sort of the short term as well as the long term costs of providing that relief that is proposed.
Thank you. We are going to go till noon, and I want to make sure we have time for the Pollution Control Agency. So thank you and your team for their input. Oh, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on a question that we had asked earlier during regular session. I'm wondering if Commissioner Stroman could just give us a ballpark idea of right now, what is our number one priority at the agency?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman, thank you for that question. We have a number of strategic priorities, but I think as you look at our budget, obviously, and particularly in the context we're in, making sure that we are maintaining those services that are incredibly important. We're seeing the value that Minnesotans are placing on our outdoors and natural resources. And so those priorities of connecting people to the outdoors, making sure that we are proactively managing our natural resources so that use does not erode the sustainability of our natural resources would be two. The mitigating climate change was another priority that the budget was built around.
Representative Heintzman, follow up.
Thank you for that opportunity, Mr. Chair. That highlights a concern that I think a lot of people have had, and that is, of course, the park funding one. I hope that we continue to have everything we need to make sure parks stay open, and hopefully we'll have staff there to make sure that we don't lose the opportunity to connect with those dollars as folks are entering those areas and enjoying the outdoors. Thank you for the opportunity for the last comment, Mr. Chair, and for the question. That'll be it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, and I know we've got to move on. Maybe this can be directed to Bob Meyer. With regards to the wolf hunt, I know the DNR has talked about that they are not ready for it because they don't have a program together. I know the extent of the amount of work that went into the program before they were taken off the list in 2011 and 12. We had two very successful management plans that went on of the taking of the gray wolf, knowing that there was three times, or I guess we were the third largest at that time in the North American continent with numbers. What kind of a expense are you talking about having a whole new rulemaking process moving forward? And what's wrong with the program you have right now, the Wolf program? And I'll just end it with that.
Commissioner Stroman or Assistant Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, I can take a stab at that, and then Commissioner Stroman can follow up if need be, if that's okay. Chairman Hansen and members, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, as you all know, we're working diligently on updating our wolf management plan. It was first done in the early 2000s. It's almost 20 years old right now. It's really important to have this consensus-driven approach. It's not consensus, but this discussion that we have with this large group of stakeholders from all facets of outdoors and wolf management. That process is probably 3/4 of the way done. If you look at it on a timeline, we're hoping to have a draft out for public comment later this summer and into the fall and address those comments and concerns and then go from there. Hopefully we can have wolf manage. We're already managing the wolf right now. We've worked with licensed controllers. We're working with wildlife services at the federal level, doing this public input. And as we saw in Wisconsin, who opened up their wolf hunt, I will say prematurely, they have now ceased and they are working on their wolf management plan to guide their activities. So making sure that we have a strong, defendable plan to talk about how we not only protect but manage the wolf in the state of Minnesota is extremely important. And that's the process we're going to follow. It's going to take a little bit of time, but it's the right way to do it. And it's the right way to do it for Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope that provides some information. And Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't know if you have any additional questions on it that I can answer, or Commissioner Stroman may be able to answer.
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair, I don't have anything to add to Commissioner Meyer's thorough answer, unless Senator Ingebrigtsen has a follow-up.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, I'd just like to go on record and ask if the DNR agrees that the gray wolf needs to be managed here in Minnesota, and I'll end with that.
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, as Assistant Commissioner Meyer stated in his response, we do manage the wolf currently with a number of activities. Our monitoring of the population is as well as the control activities that we've recently just resumed.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No, I don't want to belabor this. The DNR reacts to the wolf. Depredation is what they do. They don't manage the animals, but that's for another day, Mr. Chair. We should probably move on.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. And I have one other quick question for the commissioner. So if we go past June 30th, you mentioned about parks, but does the online licensing or permit system, are people still able to get a fishing license on July 1? I'm trying to remember, having been through several of these things in the past, does that shut down as well?
Mr. Chair, and I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Meyer if he can help, but my recollection is that there was one point in time that during shutdown discussions and given the potential of a shutdown of licensing, the legislature had concerns about that, and so has since passed legislation to allow the licensing to continue during shutdown. And if I'm incorrect on that, Assistant Commissioner Meyer can let us know, but that's my recollection.
Assistant Commissioner Meyer. And you can get back to us on that if you don't have that.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, Commissioner Stroman was correct. We did try to work through that issue, and we would have those people would be considered essential, or some of them would be considered essential to continue selling of those licenses.
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair, just a very quick question for Commissioner Stroman. The DNR, our state parks, all the great work DNR does across the state, do you have anything to do with Clean Cars rulemaking?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrison, as I think the committee is aware that rulemaking is being conducted by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, what I will say is it is a key piece of the governor's initiative on climate, which we are part of the governor's sub-cabinet on climate and have separate initiatives that relate to that larger goal.
That sounds like a segue to PCA, and we have about a half an hour left, so thank you, Commissioner, and Commissioner Bishop, welcome.
Great, thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee, my name is Laura Bishop, and I serve as the commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. There has obviously been a lot of talk already today about the MPCA, so I will try to make my comments brief here as I know we have a limited amount of time. My letter to the committee goes into quite a bit of detail, so I'll summarize some of those key points. First of all, thank you for the areas of agreement in the language before you. Funding for the St. Louis River TMDL, air appropriations in inflationary increases, the PFAS source evaluation, and the funding and the policy change that allows Minnesota's tribal nations to apply for rural recycling and composting grants. I appreciate agreement on these items. Mr. Chair and members of members, Minnesota faces daunting environmental challenges right now. Extreme weather and climate change threatens the very things that make Minnesota a great place to live, from our magnificent 10,000 plus lakes to our rich farmland and clean air. PFAS, the forever chemicals, permeate more and more of our lands and waters and will require a long-term focus on cleanup. And recent major violations by regulated entities have shown the need for new detection equipment and better compliance assistance around our air permits, especially in areas with disproportionately poor air quality. Meeting these challenges depends on the work before this conference committee in the coming days. On the challenge of preparing for extreme weather, we urge full funding of the climate resiliency grants to help communities statewide. Mayors from Staples and Fergus Falls to Lanesboro and Owatonna have all voiced their strong support for the critical infrastructure need. Communities, big and small, need help preparing for these mega storms, which too often cause needless damage to homes and prevent businesses from producing and delivering their goods. This need is very high, and we are asking that you fully fund these grants at $2.9 million. On the challenge of PFAS, you've heard for years how PFAS has contaminated drinking water wells in the East Metro. Now other communities like Bemidji face PFAS in groundwater. And we recently learned that PFAS is leaking into groundwater at 98 closed landfills statewide. At 59 closed landfills in more than 40 counties, PFAS concentrations exceed health guidance. And at 15 of these sites, the PFAS concentration leaking into groundwater is more than 10 times higher than health levels. The multi-agency Minnesota PFAS blueprint calls for three projects to fill the critical gaps around PFAS. Both the Senate and House fund one of these three, the PFAS source evaluation project. But the House funds the others, the inventory and the monitoring projects. We ask for full funding of these PFAS items that are critical. On the challenge of clean air, too many Minnesotans are adversely impacted and overburdened by air pollution. Our data shows that Black, Indigenous, people of color, and low-income Minnesotans are more likely to live near significant sources of air pollution from facilities. The MPCA wants to ensure industrial facilities in and near these communities are in compliance with environmental regulation. And we want to get to them before they become a large problem. We cannot have another case like we've seen with Water Gremlin. We need to be ahead of this, and this follows up on the legislative auditor's recommendations. The House includes funding for air compliance assistance and portable monitoring equipment, as well as policy language that allows us to focus on areas with the poorest air quality. And finally, with regard to air and regulation, we've heard a lot of talk about the Clean Cars rulemaking. We continue to oppose the language put forward by the Senate that eliminates the agency's ability to regulate motor vehicle emissions as part of our federally delegated air quality work. On-road motor vehicles are a significant contributor to Minnesota's air pollution, which negatively impacts human health, and the transportation sector is the number one emitter of greenhouse gases in Minnesota. The language in the Senate bill also goes well beyond clean cars. And I'll just say that with clean cars, it's had extensive review and public input. While no meeting was held in Brainerd due to the pandemic guidance on public meetings that came out right at that time, the agency did hold meetings in Fergus Falls,
Virginia, Marshall, Mankato, and the Twin Cities. In addition, we held numerous online forums to seek input, forums much like this one today, where people get to hear and people get to provide input. And in those forums and in our comment period, we received over 10,000 public comments. This effort was extensive in order to help ensure that the rulemaking was inclusive. Clean cars would help address the need for cleaner air, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and attract more EVs and low emissions vehicles to our state, providing more choice for Minnesotans. We expect to hear this week from the administrative law judge, and this will help guide all of us on these next steps in this process. It's also important to note that even if this rulemaking were to move forward, there's a mandatory full 2-year waiting period. So it does not go into effect and would not before 2024, model car model year 2025. And while the Senate language could end the clean cars rulemaking, another consequence of the Senate language is that meeting any future new, more stringent air quality standards from the federal or state government would need to be shouldered solely by facilities with air emissions permits from the MPCA. Stripping the agency of its ability to regulate air pollution from motor vehicles removes our ability to regulate one of the largest sources of pollution and greenhouse gases, personal vehicles, in order to meet those air quality standards. And as the Biden administration reviews national air ambient air quality standards, it's critical that the MPCA has all the tools to address air quality to ensure that the agency can look at these sources of pollution instead of solely focusing on those permitted sources. Industry has done a lot here. This is time to look at other areas where we can cut emissions. In addition to these needs around climate, PFAS, and air quality, there are several items the House includes, but the Senate omits, and current service levels will decline as a result. Our water operations funding of $3 million. Without this, we lose nearly 10% of our water program staff, and we won't be able to provide critical support that local governments expect and experience today, especially in times of crisis, such as wastewater treatment plant overflows and bypasses. The closed landfill investment fund. At stake here is our ability to respond promptly and fully to emergencies at the 110 closed landfills statewide and provide the needed upkeep as required by statute. We ask for the same tools with CLIF that we have for the 3M settlement and the National Resources Damages Fund. Our work plan would be approved by MMB and vetted with the chair and ranking members. And we thank the House and Senate for including the full funding. However, we need the flexibility and certainty of a statutory appropriation to protect health, public health and the environment. The $2 million for legal costs, and we heard this from DNR as well. Without this support, the agency will be forced to make reductions in legal services provided internally, resulting in less preparation for other legal suits and potentially higher taxpayer costs if the agency loses lawsuits as a result. The MPCA policy bills from 2020 and 2021 are included in the House language. These policy changes are needed in our work with landfills and Superfund sites, as well as PFAS, air quality, and water quality. These policy bills modernize statutes and bring efficiencies to our work. And Mr. Chair, there are a number of policy items that I'm not addressing in my testimony today. There are several Senate policies that move us backward on clean air and clean water and conflict with federal requirements and laws. Our opposition is detailed in the letter that I sent to this committee. Finally, I appreciate the inclusion of the 2020 and 2021 LCCMR language in both the House and Senate to fund two MPCA projects. The 2020 project proposed a study on PFAS and land-applied biosolids fills a critical data gap identified in the Minnesota PFAS blueprint. We asked for the House position to fully fund this work. The agency's 2021 LCCMR budget
Our project, included by both the House and the Senate, is the second phase to complete the statewide groundwater contamination mapping project to produce data that will be widely used to protect drinking water. So thank you for that. Mr. Chair, this concludes my testimony. Thank you for the chance to appear before the committee today. My team and I are happy to stand for questions, and I look forward to working together in the coming days with all of you. Thank you.
So we have a lot of questions. So Representative Wozlawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, or maybe some other folks from your team, I have a few questions on a few different topics, but the first one I want to address is PFAS. I know, you know, we had what happened with 3M and the costs of that alone. I'm wondering, you probably don't know at this point, because I know there's not a great amount of knowledge around everywhere that PFAS is in terms of if it's in drinking water, groundwater, that sort of thing. We don't have a map that shows that, but I'm wondering if you can maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what the cost is for this cleanup. These are forever chemicals, so they don't go away. So I'm wondering if you can sort of talk a little bit about that. If you don't have numbers, sort of maybe talk about what's been happening with the 3M cleanup in terms of the extent and nature of what the cleanup efforts are like if mm-hmm. this ends up in drinking water.
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Wozlawick and members of the committee. I'll answer that pretty broadly. So first, you know, we have the PFAS blueprint so that we can start identifying around the state where we have contamination. We've seen it now in our close landfills with the groundwater contamination that I've talked about as well, but really to identify how extensively it could be in both groundwater and or drinking water, as well as the impact that it could have on our crops when it's distributed. So to ballpark a number, a cost number is really difficult, and we identify the sources and identify, you know, how big the problem is. We do know that the settlement from 3M and in the East Metro and the replacement that we've seen on drinking water systems and water systems and wells is quite extensive, and that the settlement itself really doesn't cover ongoing operational costs that for many of these localities and cities. So it's a difficult piece here to grapple with, and we are going to need funding, and we are going to need this plan. Minnesota is the first state to really have this comprehensive look under our PFAS budget blueprint, our PFAS blueprint, but the overall cost is really difficult. So we can certainly go into more of that with Kirk Kadelka on the cleanup cost, but I just say that we need to get started on this year to really have that source identification, that general overview. So thank you for the question.
And Wozlawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you sort of talked about the settlement. Can you remind committee members and the public how much that settlement was for?
Yes. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my team can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was $850 million is what the settlement was for, just for the East Metro.
Representative Wozlawick.
I just have just one more thing I wanted to bring up, and not really a question, but I think there was some research that just came out recently building on decades of research that we already know that communities of color are exposed to pollution at higher levels than white communities, and also the low income versus the higher income communities. And I just wanted to point out that that's something that we're tackling in the House bill, as we're really focused on the environmental justice pieces and wanting to make sure that we're doing the work to ensure that those communities that are impacted by this pollution, that we're helping those communities and doing what we can there, but also trying to prevent this from happening again. And so I just want to sort of echo the importance of those. I know the agency has been really focused on that issue as well, but want to echo those points, and also point out that those environmental justice areas are all across the state. They're not just the metro area. This is something that impacts folks across the state. So just wanted to point that out. And I don't know if the agency knows this, but I was wondering if maybe this is a Department of Health question that I could follow up on later, but if we've seen any sort of correlation between communities that have these high levels of pollution exposure and rates of COVID, if there's any correlation. I don't know if the agency folks know that, or if I can follow up with someone else, but I was just curious to know if you've seen any research or data on that in terms of communities that we know are exposed to high-level mm-hmm. pollution.
Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Foswick, you know, there has been maps that overlay kind of the COVID and results in Minnesota, and we have overlaid that with our air quality in states. So that is something we can follow up and give you, but it is a concern. All the EJ communities that we have looked at, this is a very big concern.
I'd like to get to Representative Heintzman and then Senator Ingebrigtsen. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Bishop, I have a couple of questions and then maybe a comment. You know, obviously the discussion over California emission standards here in Minnesota is a very controversial conversation. And I'm glad that you brought it up today. It did prompt a question. As a commissioner of MPCA, this is a decision to move this process forward that is basically laying here on your desk. And I'd like to know what has the agency, what have you done to try to find some compromise with the Senate? This has been something we've been talking about, mm-hmm. and that the Senate has specifically been attempting to address with you and with your office for over a year. And I'm wondering if there has been any compromise or any offer of a solution from your office. And then I'd also like to know if there's any feedback that you've taken into account from the regulated groups and what their and if their concerns have been addressed. I think that's really important, and I honestly haven't heard anything along those lines, and I'm wondering if you could address that today.
Commissioner Bishop.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman, I'll start with how those things have been addressed. And certainly the House is taking a real opportunity to address a number of the concerns that the dealers have raised by being in the consumer-facing incentives for electric vehicles, as well as expanding the charging network and infrastructure throughout the state. So thank you to the House, Representative Heintzman, for the work on that. Appreciate that. The piece that I would say is, yes, to prepare for that and to respond to the regulated or to the dealers and the manufacturers on with regard to clean cars, we did take into account. We are expanding the infrastructure around the state already through the VW grants, but also through added funding that came through last year to expand the charging network in the state. In addition, there has been a credit a proposal that was put into the rulemaking to be able to allow for cars that have already been sold for those manufacturers to get credit for those sales prior to this going into effect. So a look back on sales. So those are in and responded things that we responded to with regard to in the process of the rulemaking and input from those parties. Second, as far as the Senate, you know, there has not been a proposal from the Senate that has come forward on this other than what you're seeing right in front of you and in this bill. So we have not seen anything that has come forward on that. And again, we're really looking at this as a larger part of a climate agenda that the governor is considering right now, and as a way to put Minnesota on a path forward on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And you know, one thing that we see here in the state is that there is a real big interest and industry around electric vehicles. So Minnesota has 16 companies and over 3,000 workers employed around cleaner transportation. It's a growing industry and great opportunity for our state to get ahead of this and create more jobs. I hope you're excited to see companies like Zeus, which is in Wyoming, Minnesota. There was an article in the Scrib this past weekend. They're creating these electric fire trucks right now. And That's what they're building. And then the new Rivian trucks, which are all electric, they're being tested up in Baudette, Minnesota. This is a state that has embraced innovations, and Minnesotans value our clean environment. We should accelerate these efforts to create jobs. We have the steel, and we have the ability, the innovation, and we have kind of the resources right here in Minnesota to be able to expand this, and this gives that the jump start.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Bishop, with all due respect, you didn't answer my question. I very specifically asked you what you have done to work with the Senate, and what you did is you responded by pointing out the Senate hasn't offered something that apparently is, in your mind, the answer to the solution. My question is to you, Commissioner Bishop, what have you done to offer something that is a compromise? This is incredibly controversial. The entire state is watching, and it's sitting on your desk, and nothing has happened to try to find a solution that could potentially release the problems that we're discussing today with this bill. This bill today is in jeopardy because you, Commissioner, are forcing a very, very controversial process here in the state of Minnesota. And it's not Minnesota's clean car rules you're pushing. You're pushing California's clean car rules. And that isn't something that's popular and nearly anywhere around the state. So if you could please just answer the question, what have you done, Commissioner, to try to work with the Senate and find resolution to this problem?
Commissioner Bishop.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Heisman, I think we look at this problem, obviously, from very two different perspectives. And I have had extensive conversations with Senator Ingebrigtsen and members of the committee. I've gone before the committee, as well as our staff has gone before the committee several times to talk about data that we're finding, and as well as the reasoning behind the proposal. And looking, and we've gone out to Greater Minnesota to ask and to bring this to the public. So we, in addition, we've had I've had personal conversations with leadership in Senate on this as well. And so I would say that I am always available, and this is not just a California standard. This is a Minnesota standard, but also 14 other states that are doing this. So I am here and available, and our staff is always working with the Senate to respond to this, to the questions that the Senate has on this, and we'll continue to do that.
Representative Heisman, we've got 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we get Senator Ingebrigtsen in. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for your description of the bill, and you and I have had conversations before with regards to that. I'm not going to comment on the remainder of the bill. I'm going to just target the cog in the wheel here, and that's the California car emissions. I'm glad you brought up cities and city councils. In fact, I've seen several city councils, and I'm just going to make a few comments and end with a question, Mr. Chair.
Lost you there, Bill. Senator Ingebrigtsen, we lost you there.
It looks like he might have fallen off.
I think he lost him.
Oh, you're back. Yep.
I'm sorry. My computer went on me here.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank goodness for staff. Thanks so much. Real quickly, because I know we've got other things to do. Just going down the list here. I know the administrative law judges meeting on Friday, and we talked about that too. And so I had good conversations with you, Commissioner, on that. I'm just going to finish with this. I'm assuming that you think it's a good policy that we're moving forward, even though we are an outlier. We're the only ones in the Midwest that are moving forward with this rulemaking process. And I'm assuming that you think it obviously is a good idea, you and the governor. My question is, if it's that good of an idea, why wouldn't you bring it to the 201 legislators to make what's arguably a very large decision here when it comes to moving forward here in the state of Minnesota? Incidentally, you're right, cars are being made, trucks are being made, so why do we have to regulate it? Why do we have to throw California emission standards into our legislation? It's very maddening to me, and I think it is for a lot of folks, because right now, and for quite some time, I've never seen anything real good come from California policy. So please just answer that question, why you don't think the 201 of us wouldn't be better served by us making this decision moving forward.
Commissioner Bishop.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I certainly don't think that it's an either or here. What we've seen in the other states is either they're directed by the legislature to undergo this rulemaking. It's always done under rulemaking, but they're either directed by the legislature or they're directed by the governor. And in this case, we were directed by the governor to undertake this rulemaking. And that's the policy of this administration.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Your volume is off. You're muted.
So what the answer is basically the administration, along with you, Commissioner, have no trust in what the decisions of Minnesota and what their concerns are moving forward with California emission standard regulations here in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair and
Commissioner Bishop, quickly.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, that's not true. That's why we have rulemaking processes. And, you know, we have a lot of rulemaking processes, one that we've just approved that you didn't intervene in or put something forward, which was on the Class 3 and 4 water standards. But, you know, this is another rulemaking process. It has had extensive review by Minnesotans, over 10,000 comments, as well as meetings that were held throughout the state. So like other rulemakings that we do, this is another rulemaking that we have put forward.
Members, we are going to have to adjourn. I want to note that we all breathe air, we all drink water, and we all eat. And those are things that we all share. We also share one planet. This is the only one we've got. And the climate is drastically being changed. We don't have a lot of time. And so what we heard today is from a lot of the agencies on their budgets and on their policy and on the House and the Senate. But we also heard that all of that will be held up for repeal, not only of the Clean Car Rulemaking, but the authority that this commissioner has in order to protect air quality. And that is a shame. We are adjourned.